under. I pull you under.
Five Finger Death Punch, our brand new number one song.
That's it for us this week. If you miss any part of the chart, get caught up at thesideshowcountdown.com.
And you can download the free iHeartRadio app so you can listen to us anywhere, anytime. See you later.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead, stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
What happens with the Riff in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas. Well, that's when we have to protect the names and voices of the not-so-innocent.
My stupid jerk friend posted pictures of me making out with some random dude I've never met before.
So you, had a good time?
I don't know. I don't remember. Just judging from all the pictures, I guess it looked like I had a blast.
Oh, well. Time to forge your own embarrassing stories. Because WRIF Sin City Takeover returns starting September 17th. Presented by Elias Financial. Call 1-800-CALL-WILL. Also by Dr. Michael Gray of the Michigan Cosmetic Surgery Center and Skin Deep Spa. More info and your Riff Cybercrew Totally Unfair Internet Advantage at WRIF.com.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome, everyone, and welcome back to us.
Look what the cat dragged in.
Yeah, you know, every other talk show in America sent their hosts down to the Republican and Democratic conventions in Tampa and in Charlotte.
Yeah.
And we asked the WRIF management to...
We did?
We wanted to do this. Instead, they sent us to a bar in Ferndale and told us to watch it on television.
Well, I didn't watch... I mean...
So we're back.
Yes, we're back. I didn't watch any of the Republican. I couldn't stomach it. Of course, I read everything about it. But I did catch four of the speeches this week.
In the Democratic one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I caught a few. In both. Actually, here's what I'd like to do. Help us out. Well, wait a minute. Let's set some of the logistics, the basics of all of this. Welcome to the broadcast. This is WRIF's long-running phone-in talk show, and it's not just Detroit's longest-running talk show. It's actually the longest-running talk show in the country, and possibly then it may make it in the world.
I wouldn't be surprised
at all. So here is the deal, though. We only do this once a week because this is a rock station, right? So I don't think we get the creds. I don't know. You know, I don't know how you know, if you go.
There's cred enough.
Yeah. Okay.
We don't need that kind of thing because we're real.
Yeah, we're real. If you'd like to join us on the air, WRIF has made this night call number available for you. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743. You can tell we had a week off.
We had a week off. Yeah, it was Labor Day. Most Labor Days in most countries are May 1st. International Working Men's Day, and now Working People's Day, of course. But, hey, I'll take them whenever we can get them.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That's our email address. If you'd like to write us a little, you know, comment. Sometimes we read some of them on the air. Probably the shorter, the better. Also, join us on Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall. Likes liked, right?
Absolutely.
John Miller in the other room screening the call, so you'll reach him first. Tell him what you want to talk about. Don't give him a long story, because he just wants to get your name and what city you're from.
Just your info.
Yeah. If you don't, and if you don't
like... He's busy producing in there.
Yeah. If you don't like what we're saying, don't take it on John. He's...
We always have to remind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
John, are you with us? I don't see you up on our board. I just see... type something somewhere just to let us know you're with us, okay? And John will put together, I'm here. John will put together a podcast, which will appear at noon on Monday tomorrow. But here's the help that I would like, and I say I, because I haven't even discussed this with Jalene. But, I just get, on one hand, sort of overwhelmed, underwhelmed, and just sick of all this political party crap. Not that I don't think that one is just absolutely terrible, awful, insane, psycho.
You don't?
What?
It's not that you don't think that.
I do. That
okay.
means I do. Yeah.
Right.
And, one's better than the other. But I don't necessarily want to put this on everybody. You tell me what you made of these conventions, if anything.
Yeah.
Did you watch them? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I wonder...
What did you think of Jennifer Granholm if you saw
Jennifer Granholm, ex-governor of Michigan, gave like a five-minute speech about the auto bailout, right? And she was so over the top, so animated, yelling and flailing her arms around, that she made both the right wing and the liberal talks or news sites. The right wingers said she had lost it, and the liberal ones said she was such a ball of energy.
I loved it, and a couple of Republicans have said it was kind of like that Howard Dean. Remember when he freaked out and at the end he went roar.
Well, I think someone must have told Jennifer Granholm, who's a very, very wonderful woman, and certainly didn't do the damage to Michigan that a lot of right-wingers claim. But she's usually very moderate. I think they might have said, Jennifer, get in the hell.
Light a fire under your ass, J.G.
So 313-298-WRIF, what, if anything, did you make of it? Maybe nobody in the RIF audience even listened to it.
And I don't know. But our audience is combined with
that
audience.
Well, that's what I mean. There's a RIF audience, and then there's an audience that only listens to this show because it's a political talk show.
Right.
So, obviously, the political people, the people that are interested in political talk shows, I'm sure they at least did what Jalene did, which is to watch the Democratic one. Maybe it's a Republican.
I usually just read this stuff, Peter. You know that. But I started watching television again. And I knew that Michelle Obama was coming up. I admire her as a fellow female.
Yeah.
And I thought she was wonderful.
Well, she is a very appealing person, and Ann Romney just looks like every rich, privileged...
cold bitch.
Okay. You heard it from her, not from me, folks. Trying to show that they're actually one of the people where, they're up there in the stratosphere. They've she's saying, we had to struggle, we lived in a basement.
Please. Yeah. Oh, cry me a river.
Did you ever hear that Monty Python routine where they're pretending these old rich guys, and they're sitting around the club, and one of them said, we were so poor, we lived in a shoebox in the middle of the road. And he said, you had a shoebox? You're lucky.
So we outpour each other.
Yeah. Those are just spectacles. Those are just, shows.
It's kind of pomp and circumstance.
Because the idea that you would have someone's wife get up there on either party is kind of weird.
It is kind of weird. I agree. But Michelle was great.
Because, they used to have conventions, and I can't remember, within the last 50 years or so, I was listening to this, and they were talking about it. And what they would, both George Romney, Not George. Mitt.
You caught yourself.
Yeah, George was the guy that was born in Mexico.
Yeah, his papa.
Yeah, it's papa.
With all of his wives.
With all, he didn't have his his grandfather had all
the
wives.
Yeah, one of them. Yeah.
Now you totally made me forget what I was going to say.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. So Mitt Romney. Oh, yeah. So they both got nominated on the first ballot. There was one of these elections where they had to take 105 votes in the convention to finally get the nominee. I can't remember what party or what candidate it was. So they were real serious wheeling and dealing conventions.
Yeah.
This, again, is just
it's a show.
Really big show.
Yes, yeah. It is. Yeah. And I did watch one thing from the Republican National Convention, but I watched it on YouTube, and that was old
Clint Eastwood.
What is... He has some problems. He needs to stay off that podium and behind the camera.
Well, this is...
Or even in front of the camera, but...
This is another case of the right wing said he was just wonderful.
Did they really?
Yeah. They just loved him.
I thought it was awful.
Here, John writes from the other room. We got to get him a microphone. That's how you started, right?
No, you never let me.
Oh, anyway, he said, John Wright, someone I know compared to having the wives speak would be like the preacher's wife giving a sermon.
Oh, okay. Well,
that's not so bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so Clint Eastwood, yeah, all the Republicans just say he nailed it. He was incredible.
He was ridiculous.
Bill Maher said that he encapsulated the Republican Party, an old white man talking to a man that isn't there.
So true. Oh, that's good.
And what he did, folks, he put up a chair and pretended that was Obama. And so...
Yeah, just an empty chair.
And again, I mean, if you can... wait a minute here. Let's... we usually don't go to calls for quite a bit. But here's Mike in Birmingham. And Mike... we'll get you on a little early. You had a comment about Clint Eastwood in the empty chair, huh?
Yeah, he made a complete idiot of himself.
Didn't he?
He's such an idiot. He was such an idiot.
It was a spectacle.
he made a spectacle of himself. He embarrassed. I think he embarrassed the whole Republican Party the way he acted.
Yeah, but these people, can you believe anyone thought that was good?
I'm telling you, Mike, all these right wingers thought he was great, and just he was got up there extemporaneously, didn't have any notes, didn't have anything, and just started kind of babbling. You know,
so, what a fool! What a fool!
He was babbling. I truly am over him. I'm done with him.
All right, Mike. Thank you very much. There was a couple of things. And all right, here's what I'm interested in, whether you watch those conventions and what you thought, whether or not they convinced you. I somehow cannot imagine that there are people that said, oh, wow, I was going to vote for Romney, but I just saw Jennifer Granholm.
I saw that riveting speech, and I'm changing my ways.
Yeah. Let's see. What else? One of the things that they were, Bill Maher was talking about, he said that the reason that the Republicans may win is because they're going to lie, cheat, and steal. You know, he minces no words.
Right.
And puts his money where his mouth is.
Yeah.
He gave $1 million to the Obama campaign.
He did.
Bill Maher did. Can you believe, I wouldn't have taken him from having that much, taken him for having that much spare money. Would you?
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, he's a television star, but he's also an author. And he has a long career. He acted. And,
I know.
I don't know. Maybe he's just good with his money. Maybe he's invested.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if they've called about it. I don't think you come up. I could come up with more than like $200,000 or something.
You could?
That's a joke, son.
Peter.
$20.
Now, another highlight of mine of the Republican National Convention that I didn't watch was our friends from the group Code Pink.
Oh, yeah.
They attempted to, they're anti-war protesters, and
right.
they were trying to arrest Condi.
Condi
for war
Rice.
Crimes.
Yeah.
But they got stopped, you know, and then they dressed up like vaginas like the next day. I love those women.
They did. Because they wanted to confront the Republicans about their anti-woman agenda, against pro-choice, against contraception, all of that.
Against women.
But how do you dress up like a vagina?
Well, it was like a giant walking vagina, like a little vagina suit, like a Halloween costume.
Yeah, they went.
I think that's what I'm going to be for Halloween.
There you go. Kind of. I know what I'm going to be.
Oh, no.
Some people will say I already am, though.
Oh, Peter.
Bill Maher, this is the man that knows. What am I doing in here? Can you know, maybe we should take a bunch of weeks off. Leave us to John Miller. He's doing great. Bill Maher also bought 6% ownership of the New York Mets, about $30 million. How could the guy have that much money?
He's got dough, Peter. Telling you.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think he makes a lot of money hosting that talk show.
He makes
more than we do. Let's put it that way.
Yeah,
a lot.
I don't know. I mean, when Maher says that they lie, cheat, and steal, the Republicans do, what he is talking about is the just unending amount of lies told by the Republicans about Obama, about the Democrats. But they're small lies. You heard this thing about Paul Ryan said that...
Which thing?
I want to just get the small stuff. I want to get the big stuff. I don't want to necessarily... Maybe no one's going to care about... the economy or bailouts or stimuluses or anything like that. But Paul Ryan said that he had done a marathon in under 3 hours. And then it turned out Runner's World said, actually it was over 4 hours that he did.
Well, he keeps making things up, right?
Yeah. And the other thing, you know, Senator Marco Rubio, who many people thought was going to be the vice presidential candidate for the Republicans, he forever would talk about his parents were defectors from Castro's Cuba. And then it turned out they left before Castro took power.
Oh, God, what a liar.
Yeah, yeah. Also, Rubio in that speech.
It's because they have nothing else, Peter.
Well,
They don't have anything of concrete value to offer.
Well, there's frightening stuff. Senator Rubio also said, faith in our Creator is the most important value of all. So this is a man that is one of the forces, the political forces in this country that wants to drive us towards a theocracy. I mean,
where religion rules.
Where religion rules. One nation under God, and we always say the country best exemplified by that is Iran.
Yeah, thank you.
So we don't.
Thank you. Do we want to be like Iran?
That's why the founding fathers wanted a secular nation, right?
They sure did.
Yeah.
They kind of, you know, put it in a document.
They did. They did indeed. Hey, you know, where can I find this on my, I got it. All right.
Okay.
You don't even know what I'm doing.
No. Yeah. You're up to all kinds of little things over
because
here.
Because I was thinking of the different programs and the
social programs?
The party platforms of the two parties.
Okay.
Which the Republican one is extraordinarily frightening. The Democrats, of course, is a lot better.
There's some scary stuff in there.
Some bad stuff in there. You know what I was thinking? Because you know what today is? Today is the 41st anniversary of when John Lennon issued Imagine.
Yes.
And that is a radical program that has always surprised me that a song with those lyrics became so popular. In fact, because this is WRIF.
We can do it.
Not classic rock. We can do it by Perfect Circle.
He doesn't cuss, does he?
No, I hope not.
Ooh, it's eerie.
Yeah.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell.
Now, the Republicans would not like this.
No.
Imagine all the people.
But they're so dumb, they probably think it's just a cool song.
Living for today, that's hedonism!
Imagine there's no country.
No countries?
It isn't hard to do.
It is for a lot of people, particularly them.
To kill or die for.
Whoa, listen to this line now.
What?
No religion to.
Gutsy.
Imagine all the people living
is a great version, actually, isn't it? This is Perfect Circle. Now listen to this line! One world, one world, one world. What do you think about this song? How did it ever get so popular?
I know, with the masses.
Now, wait till the next chorus. You may all know this, but think about this. This is quite a production.
Yeah, I dig it.
Sharing all the work.
You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one.
All right, I'm sure some of you are going to hate me for turning this off. And sometimes
well,
I think
you can always look it up on YouTube.
Yeah, that's Perfect Circle. And that's, all right, all of a sudden my brain is.
Yeah, it's a great song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, the words, if you're missing any, imagine there's no heaven, no hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine there's no country. It isn't hard to do, nothing to kill or die for, and no religion, too.
Phew. Yeah.
Imagine John no Lennon, possessions. Man. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger, a brotherhood of man, which now, you know, that was 41 years ago. Imagine all the people sharing all the world.
Mm.
That guy was a commie.
Yeah, I loved him. Loved him. Oh,
yeah.
That was cool. Nice little surprise there.
Yeah,
Eric.
Yeah. So
thank you.
That in fact, if you want to hear, it's actually, I don't know. It probably could. Well, I was going to say it depends on what age group you fall into. Maybe not. There's such a sweet video on my website, and it's up on the Facebook page as well, right?
Is it?
Yeah, you put it there.
I did.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's facebook.com/nightcall, and it's John Lennon sitting at that white piano playing it.
Oh, yeah, I did.
And Yono.
Yoko.
Ono. Yeah.
Yono, I like that, though. Shorten it up.
I knew the Ono brothers, actually.
For real?
I did, yeah. Hi, guys. Yoko walking into the room and opening all these curtains so this light just begins flooding in. It's very,
beautiful,
very dramatic.
Beautiful, yeah.
So let me ask you this. Why is that song so popular? It has politics so far off the chart of what we're looking at today that you would think that would be relegated with
I think it just John Lennon had such a sweet way of writing the music to things that he kind of it glossed over people, and it became such a huge hit. Still is today. People, they think it's this inspiring, you know, I mean, it is for us, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But people who don't necessarily believe those lyrics, if they actually listen to them.
Well, think about, what's the famous Bruce Springsteen one, Born in the USA, that Reagan liked. And I'm thinking, I mean, well, he was.
Well, and I listened to that the other day again when I was on the air. And really, I always didn't like the song because I thought it was all pro, you know.
USA.
And, I mean, not that I'm anti my country people, okay, but we do a lot of really.
Sort of blindly chanting that is always a little. And the Democrats.
Yeah,
we're doing it,
much.
By the way.
Yeah, I know.
So,
I saw it.
All right. We've got some calls coming in. We'll get you in just a second.
I got an email. Can I?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. This is from, I'm not sure who it's from. Anyway, saw Jennifer Granholm's speech at the DNC, was reminded of her State of the Union address a few years back when we were going to be blown away. Do you remember that?
No.
Yeah. Wish she were still governor. Then he said Clinton rocked. He was the clarifying moment of the DNC. He's a great orator. What? No one can argue with that, left or right.
You know who was one of the delegates there was Monica Lewinsky's rabbi.
Yeah, what was up with that?
He just happened to be there. Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler magazine, is offering $1 million for anyone who will provide him with Mitt Romney's financial records. He took out a full-page ad in today's Washington Post, and he's going to have one on Tuesday in USA Today. The ad text read, "What is he hiding? Maybe now we'll find out." The ad also includes a phone number and email address where anyone with information can contact Flint.
Larry Flint, hustler.
He's
working all the P's.
Yeah, he's...
politics and...
Well, he always has, yeah.
You know what else.
During the impeachment trial of Clinton, this ruse that the Republicans put together in the late 90s, he made a $1 million offer for evidence of martial infidelity against Republican members of the House who were leading the trial against Clinton. The offer led to incoming House Speaker Bob Livingston resigning after evidence of his own affair was publicly revealed.
I forgot that one.
And let's see, in 2007, Flint offered a financial reward for evidence showing that Louisiana Republican Senator David Vitter had cheated on his wife. Vitter has remained in office even after the evidence was made public that he was consorting with prostitutes. Yeah. Okay.
Makes it sound so nice. Consorting.
Yeah, right. Wow, man, this is cruel here. Here's Art in Roseville. Hey, Art, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Good evening. I find it extremely interesting that the two Democratic heroes from the convention, Clinton and Ted Kennedy, both of them are scumbags, and I'll tell you why. Number one, Bill Clinton, when he groped that woman in the White House, according to Michigan law, that would be fourth-degree criminal sexual conduct.
Which woman? You mean Monica Lewinsky?
No, the one he... There's so many of them. The one he did in the White House where he touched her breast and had her up against the wall. Remember that one?
Yeah, okay.
So. Okay.
I don't remember, but anyway. That's Bill.
And then we got Ted Kennedy. We got, that hero who ran away and hid for 8 hours while this young lady's drowning in a car. I make the case that if my dad had dumped that woman in a drink, he would have dove in that water 50 times to try to save her.
Well, it's too bad your dad wasn't from Massachusetts. Maybe he'd become the senator. So what does that tell you?
Oh, and
what does that tell you?
Well, it just tells me and then I was going to point out my hero, a lot of Republicans, many, many Republicans. I call him Rinaldus Maximus. You know who that is,
no,
right?
No.
Yeah, Ronnie Reagan. And,
Ronald Reagan.
He's your hero?
He was an FBI informant that he finked on his fellow union members when he was head of the Screen Actors Guild. He's a pretty dishonorable guy. When he was a governor, he was responsible for the deaths of students when he called out the National Guard on students that were taking part in their right to protest, and an innocent student got shot to death by, I guess it was an Alameda County Sheriff. And plus, he initiated Reaganomics that has got us in the hole that we're in.
He started the demise of this country.
Ronald Reagan was probably one of the worst presidents. Well, no, I mean, there's some others. Ulysses S. Grant, Harding.
In this kind
But go ahead,
time
Art.
Frame.
Then can I test the issue of hypocrisy? This worthless thing we have in the White House right now, the ultimate worthless hypocrite, he wants to use government force to steal your money and force you to be your brother's keeper, and yet he can't.
Well, wait. Isn't that you can spin that in any way you want. Yeah, I mean, when you have a government that's elected by the people, you have certain policies, for instance, that come about because, they're elected into office. So you could say that, we are being made to take care of our elderly because of Social Security and Medicare. And you could either spin it that that's what a community of people that care about one another, that would be kind of
a high-functioning society,
and why it's a left view, I don't know. The right view is that they're stealing your money to help other people. And one of the things we always talk about...
And you mean on the right, not correct.
Yeah. Is that people on the right, I would say, have no compassion. And Art, you're a perfect example. Well, okay. Art has nothing more to say, and I don't blame him. Thank you, Art. Bye. By the way, throughout my radio career, I have often
long radio career, I've often
felt that I've been put in the position of having to defend people that
to defend the poor and the elderly.
No, that's okay. That I love to do that.
Me too.
Against these heartless conservatives.
Yeah.
But no, to defend people that that I'm really critical of.
I see what you're saying.
Critical of Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Kennedy, did he make an error at Chappaquiddick? Yeah.
Yeah, pretty
sounds
bad
like
one.
He did. And if he wasn't a real rich guy, would something maybe have happened, as Art said? Very possible. But, I wind up defending people because of these attacks on him. Hey, one of the things, of course, we know, the Republicans are the home of homophobia.
Well, you got that right.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're against marriage equality.
Yeah.
Marriage
is between a man and a woman.
And we know so because, and here is, would be, I would say, their downfall. And how do we know that, I mean, traditionally it is. That's absolutely true. But lots of things change as history progresses. For instance, we were always in governments prior to the 17th and 18th century and 19th century as well. We were subjects. That is, there was a ruler, and we were the subjects of the ruler. The revolutions of the era I just mentioned changed us into citizens with defined rights, particularly ours, which has a constitution which grants us that. So that was this incredible change. I mean, for 4,000 years, government was absolutely nothing else than a racket to protect the wealth and privilege and power of the wealthy.
That sounds so damn familiar.
It still is, but what we've been able to do, we the common people, is eke out a bit of rights in some places, not most places, but in some places. We've had the right to speak our mind, not everywhere, that's for sure, and all that. So things do change. And it used to be, for instance, people of African descent were slaves. And then, the conservatives wanted to keep it like that.
Oh,
you had to
fight
a goddamn war to make that not happen.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah. So, but the revolutions of let's just talk about ours. Our revolution was about extending rights to all. And at first, I'm not going to go through this history lesson again. I've done it too many times. Was for white propertied males, white men with property. Everybody else, you're out of here.
Yeah, you don't count.
So that exclusion is now increasingly, at least formally, a lot of those prejudices remain, in some cases are dominant, but it's now gay people, finally. Women, not so long ago.
Yeah.
Disabled, all those people that were said to be outside the general consensus are now brought in. So things do change.
They evolve.
Yeah. But the Republicans, of course, like conservatives who have always been, always been on the wrong side of every single social question since the origins of this country, have been wrong ever. And I always put out this offer, Jalene and I put it out. Is there anyone can tell us when the conservatives were ever correct? Ever.
Maybe Art knows.
Yeah, maybe Art knows. Should I go through the litany? Conservatives wanted to remain part of Britain. They were against the revolution. They were for slavery. They were against the women's vote. They were against labor unions. They were for every war, no matter how wrong and bad and based on lies it was. They're against the gay movement, the women's movement. I'm sure I'm leaving out stuff.
Yeah.
They were against Social Security. They were against Medicare. They were
child labor laws.
Were against child labor laws. They still are, some of them.
Right.
Because they're libertarians, right? And you don't want to restrict the free market. And if a 12-year-old does, or a 12-year-old, if an 8-year-old doesn't want to work in a factory the way they used to, he should go work somewhere else.
Right. Unreal.
You're getting it. But I wanted to, maybe we come back. We're starting to get full up. Michael and Dave and Fred and Mike, want to talk, and Dave wants to talk about, Art, who just called. So,
and
we'll,
you can too. We have a couple of open lines, so feel free to call.
Yeah, and we'll get Mr. Announcer too. But I want to just talk just when we get back. So guys, hold on. And but I just want to talk about Republican gays.
There
are some.
There are.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Clipping coupons. Standing in line at 4 a.m. Buying five to get one free. Maybe it's me, but I don't think it should be that hard to save money. Which is why we made Geico.com so easy. Just a few clicks and you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance. And when you switch to Geico, you can do practically everything online. Report a claim, update your policy, even pay your bill. Click, bam, boom. Visit Geico.com today. Click, bam, boom. I'm rather fond of that one.
The food in your grocery store comes with an expiration date, but the hard drive in your computer doesn't. Without warning, your computer could crash, and you could lose your files forever. Are your files backed up right now and ready to survive a crash? They will be if you have automatic online backup from Carbonite. Plans for home and small business start at just $59 a year. Start your free trial at Carbonite.com with offer code PROTECT and get two bonus months with purchase. Carbonite.com. Offer code PROTECT.
Everything that rocks. Worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, you're Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. And we're asking whether you watch the Democratic or Republican convention, what your thoughts were. And we haven't really gotten into it. Bill Maher
there's
said
so much to talk about.
Yeah,
really.
Bill Maher said that they're going to that the Republicans could win because they lie, cheat, and steal.
Well,
lie because they have just been putting out the most amazing set of lies about Barack Obama and the Democratic Party.
Just more over the top than ever.
Cheat because, hey, that's how they won the 2000 and 2004 elections. They're trying to exclude as many voters as possible. And steal just because they're pumping about $400 million at least into the election cycle. But we were talking about Republican gay groups who were kind of squaring off against each other. And I know that seems like some weird contradiction in terms that anybody gay could be part of a party that won't define them as full human beings.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It says here, but this is from we weren't on last week. So this was on this was a news account during the Republican convention. In Tampa, an older gentleman in a sparkling cowboy suit and matching hat made out of sequins gazed at a pair of buff male go-go dancers wearing tight jeans and skimpy tank tops that read, "Freedom is fabulous." That was the scene at the local gay bar called the Honey Pot on Tuesday night, and more than 800 Republican delegates, along with members of the local Tampa gay community and reporters, clustered to listen to the colorful conservative gay group GOP Proud make the case for electing Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, which seems is really bizarre. And so as the party gets more and more gay, it turns out that this was the largest event hosted by a gay group at any Republican convention. So what's the cliche? Go figure. I mean, the more anti-gay the party gets, the more
that's
people they
is.
Attract. What is up with that?
I don't get it at all. I mean, to me, it just has to be a financial thing, a fiscal thing. I don't.
Yeah. Let's see. A couple of these guys said they were disappointed with the Republican Party platform officially adopted on Tuesday, which calls for a constitutional amendment that would bar gay couples from obtaining civil marriages, even in states that allow it.
Yeah.
I thought these guys were all about states' rights. And Mitt Romney,
it's convenient.
Yeah. Mitt Romney signed a pledge during the primary that he embraces that same plank. Wow. Earlier.
Yeah, how can you vote against yourself?
Yeah. When I was saying that the reason that I think that we're moving along out of these prejudices is that the idea that, that same-sex marriage, marriage equality, is not acceptable has a religious basis to it. I mean, if it's not a religious basis, you just don't. What do you care who people are marrying, right?
Or what they're doing in their bedrooms?
None of your beeswax.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, it's their bedroom.
However, what we're talking about is the religious part is this religious ceremony. But at the end, any preacher or rabbi or whoever marries you, they say, by the power invested in me by the state of Michigan. So that's a political, official state recognition of a union, which carries with it about 100 guarantees in different facets of life that are available to people that are married. If you're not married, if you're just living together, if you're a man and a woman, a man and a man, and a woman, that's not available to you. Well, there is something called the U.S. Constitution that calls for both due process and equal protection under the law by the political by political entities, county, state, federal government. So, I don't think the Anti-Marriage Act.
It's got a little Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA.
Yeah, Defense of Marriage Act. That guess who signed that? Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
Right. So, he's not exactly our fave. But any event, it was Republicans that sponsored it, and he just whatever. You know, I got other things in my mind. religions, if they don't want to marry people of anything, they're welcome to do it. But legally, just like before, it was illegal in states for blacks to marry whites in Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
It was illegal for Jews to marry, stuff like that. That's a different thing. That's what it'd be like.
Amazingly enough, there are still, remember that church down in somewhere in the South that wouldn't marry the interracial couple, I believe.
Or a black couple.
Or a black couple. Yeah.
But actually, you know what? I confuse my examples. Not allowing gay people to marry is like Nazi Germany laws not allowing Jews to marry.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's very similar to. So churches can continue to refuse to marry whoever the hell they want. I don't care. You know, it doesn't mean anything. I mean, it does.
It's still rude.
Yeah, it is rude, and it is, you know, like 12th century
crap. It's very full of hatred.
Yeah, and but legally, under our Constitution, and you got to remember, it's not a matter of a majority on this. You know what? They did this poll after the famous, now what is it, almost 50 years ago, Martin Luther King Jr.'s March on Washington for Equality. You know how many, you know what the percentage of Americans who supported that march was? 23%.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, we were still so deep.
Shameful.
Yeah, still so deep in prejudice and discrimination.
Terrible.
But, you know, the Congress came up with laws that supported formal rights for people. The Supreme Court upheld it. Okay, back.
Good things can happen.
Yes, yeah. All right. Hang on, folks. We'll get you all on. Here's Dave in Ypsilanti. Dave, you wanted to talk about Art, the conservative caller who was saying that Clinton and the late Senator Ted Kennedy were scumbags, as he put it.
Well, yeah, part of me doesn't want to disagree with him, but I'm always incensed whenever I hear someone talk about how they think Ronald Reagan was the greatest president who ever lived.
Thank you.
I mean, just ask any air traffic controller.
Right.
You got that right.
Well, talk about biting the hand that feeds you. Let me just run this by people. The air traffic controllers, this union, they called Petco, that was the name of their union, they endorsed Ronald Reagan, and then a little after his election, they went out on strike, and he fired them all.
Of course, you know, that's the way Republicans do things, you dare to go up against them, you know, you're gone, you're fired, you know.
Yeah.
And you're talking about lying, cheating, and stealing about the Republicans, and I think that's all they can do, to be quite honest with you.
It's pretty prevalent.
I'm so worried, you know, if Mitt Romney wins this election.
I know.
You know, it just seems like it's going to be I read this the other day, a surrender to greed. You know, we finally decided that this country is based on greed and money and, you know, and forget the Constitution.
Power.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
the power to enforce greed.
And that scares me to death.
Well, you know, there's a famous recording of, what is this guy's name? Our talk show colleague Tom Hartman always plays it, and it's this Republican operative, a very famous one, and the name's right out of my brain, Paul Weyrich or something like that. Any event, John Miller, our phone screener and producer, will figure that one out real quickly. Anyway, there's this recording of him of saying that people are always urging everyone to vote. And he said, we don't want that at all. We want the voting pool to be as small as possible. Because in that the conservative movement, for all their rhetoric, really all are only about supporting the upper 1%, if everybody votes and votes their interest, well, you know, they're going to get run out of town.
Yeah.
So what they're involved in is all this voter suppression. That's how they stole the 2000 election. And, these voting machines that they control, the Republican secretaries of state in places like Ohio now and Ohio in 2004 and Florida in 2000 were the campaign managers of the Republican and, what's that guy's name? George Bush. I remember. You didn't hear that except for his brother whining. Stop blaming everything on my brother.
Oh, God. He's so repulsive.
All right, Dave. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here is this is Mike in Jackson. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I know you're so smart. I'm confused. Did Bill Clinton's limo driver take him to the wrong convention? Or he was at the Democrat convention. I thought Bill Clinton was a Republican. NAFTA, free trade, welfare reform, end welfare as we know it, crime bill, 100,000 more cops on the street, V-chip. He just mentioned the Marriage Defensive Act. He suggested extending the Bush-era tax cuts. He praised Mitt Romney's business career. Did the limo take a wrong turn, or
or what?
Yeah. Well, we've always said Bill Clinton was a good Republican.
Yeah, you haven't, you're not getting any argument from me. Both he and Barack Obama, if they were in Britain, I think they would probably be in the conservative party there. They would might be in the left wing of the conservative party, but they would. They're at best center-rightist. And, Bill Clinton, the legislation that he signed off, and this doesn't, as far as I'm concerned, let him off the hook in the slightest.
The FCC?
The FCC thing that allowed this gobbling up of all these conglomerates of, what was it, Clear Channel and like 1,100 stations at one time control. These were mostly Republican bills that he signed. And so people say, and all the Democrats, most of the Democrats voted against it. But no, I think your point's well taken. I don't disagree with you in the slightest, except for one thing. You sounded very eloquent, and I was actually very impressed on you rattled that all off. But you misspoke yourself. You said the Democrat convention instead of the Democratic convention. So I thought I'd correct you.
Okay, well, that's cool. I'm trying to quit smoking cigars, so if I run into them, that'll give me a reason not to bum one off of them.
You remember the cigar thing?
Oh, my God. Well, I can't believe it took me that long.
Yeah. All right. The only thing I would say in closing, Mike, that should all make you happy and like Bill Clinton. Every criticism I have of Barack Obama, every criticism I have of Bill Clinton is from the left of them. They're not as far left as I'd like to see. All right. Thank you for that. By the way, this is going to be interesting, whoever wins. Right now, Barack Obama, according to a lot of, not polls, but the way the Electoral College.
But even polls.
Yeah. Were they what?
Polls, like the what yeah, I read that one today, 47% and 43%. It's widening, but you know how the polls.
Well, who knows what kind of October surprise is going to come about for either. I mean, how they're going to do in these debates. One of the things they're always talking about with Mitt Romney, I can't believe it, they say, we're going to humanize him. Like, what is he, some replicant? You know, they go, I am the, we gotta make him more, and there's Anne always stroking. We've always helped the poor.
Ice queen.
Yeah, right.
Gosh, she's repulsive.
But, so let's look at two scenarios. Barack Obama is reelected. For one thing, I don't know what is going to happen. The right wing will go absolutely bonkers over the edge. And I don't know how that will manifest itself. Unless the Democrats really sweep the Senate and the House, which doesn't look like they will. And remember, they had the majority in both houses.
I know. And look what difference it made. None.
Yeah, right. So nothing's going to change. I mean, all the programs that at least Obama and most of them were pretty weak tried to put forth that would have gone beyond where we are now were shot down by the Republicans. And, they're saying, oh, look at this shabby job report that came out. They only added 76,000 jobs in August. George Bush was losing 750,000 a month.
I wish people knew these kind of things.
And that's what Clinton said. He said, I never could have.
Everything's so isolated, all these numbers.
I never could have fixed this, given what he was handed, because this was 30 years of Reaganomics that finally sank the economy.
Well, that exploded or imploded with Iraq and Afghanistan.
The bailouts and the stimulus were ones that Paul Ryan, for instance, voted for and probably saved American capitalism and probably fended off a worldwide depression, right?
Yes.
Okay, so I don't think things are going to change too much, under Obama's reelection. Things will really go down the tubes if Romney and Ryan get elected. They have no plan whatsoever. Now, they're starting to, say, I'm not going to lower the taxes on the rich. Romney just said that today. But they have no real problem. I mean, the only real government plan, that, and it wasn't George Bush's policies about jobs that lost all those jobs is what you said. I mean, yeah. It was the end of Reaganomics, the final crash of it. It was these unfunded wars. It was the tax cut. Well, I'm sorry. I made a mistake. It was his tax cuts for the wealthy that did a part of it. But the only thing that the government could really do is have a massive multi-billion-dollar stimulus jobs program. Divert all this money from the war economy that's not necessary, not doing very much for the economy, and just rebuild this country. You know, build schools and hire teachers and bridges and ferries and what.
And quit taking away, for example, the Detroit cops who are going to see a pay cut, longer shifts.
12
you know,
hours?
That was just
real, Detroit
yeah.
cops?
I mean, my
working
God.
12, you know what stress they're under? I wouldn't like to meet. There's nothing against you guys, but you know, you get a little testy after 8 hours, 12 hours.
Especially what they see when they're out on the job.
Yeah.
I mean, my God.
So, I don't know. A Romney Ryan ticket would, but by 2016, it'll be Ryan for president, and they'll have someone further to the right of Ryan as the vice president.
Shudder. Yeah, shudder.
Let's see. Let's get Mike, Michael from Fenton on. He's been waiting a long time. Go ahead, Michael. You're on the air. Michael? Michael?
Yeah,
hi.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good. Where are you, Michael? You sound like you're way across
the
room.
Are you in the shower?
I was over there turning the radio down.
Okay.
Oh, good. Good job.
Good. You're coming closer and closer to your phone. Go ahead.
Come to us.
I wanted to talk about those guys who are having their conventions there, you know, but I'm under the understanding that you guys are atheists, you know.
Yeah.
I just think that that's kind of communism and inept, and those people that believe in that are lost. But
do you think we're lost?
Yeah.
I think that people who are religious are a little lost, to be honest with you.
Well, you don't have to be religious, and, you know, there's atheists. And then,
I think it's kind of a crutch, to be honest with you.
Well, I'm not saying I'm religious. I'm just saying to be atheist is communism.
No, it's not.
You know, there's
That's ridiculous. Those are two different things, man.
You know, up until just recently, the majority of atheists in American society were Republicans. Like all the people that follow Ayn Rand, although Paul Ryan is a religious Catholic. I mean, like Ayn Rand was extraordinarily anti-religious. So, these sort of rugged individualists, all of that. But, you're confused. All right.
Wait,
thanks,
here's
Michael.
What you should do. Go to the Google or go to dictionary.com and look up those two words. Start there.
They're kind of different.
Yeah.
All right, I want to get the rest of you guys on. And you notice I keep using the gender-specific identification. You know why that is?
Why?
There's no women calling.
Come on, ladies.
Is it me?
Make me proud.
All right, we'll be right back. And, I wanted, there's a couple of Hazel Park women. They're going to challenge the Michigan's marriage amendment that says that they're, you can only have, and this
you
is
can't
in the
adopt is what it is.
Yeah, but also no, they're now they're extended that to challenge the constitutional amendment to the Michigan Constitution that says marriage is only allowed between
Good,
a man and a woman.
Good, they're fed up. Go.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Bah, bah, black sheep, have you any wool? No, sir, no, sir. Some nincompoop with pantyhose pulled over his face stole all my wool sweaters and gaming system. Luckily, the Geico Insurance Agency recently helped me with renter's insurance. Everything stolen was replaced, and the little boy who lives down the lane was caught trying to sell it online. Call Geico and see how easy it is to switch and save on renter's insurance.
Detroit's Rock Station, on the web. Thanks for listening to WRIF.com.
Thank you.
Taylor's third annual Rocktoberfest, September 22nd at Heritage Park in Taylor. More details at WRIF.com. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. This is our second hour. In 12 hours, our phone screener and producer, John Miller, will have up on our Facebook page and at WRIF.com a podcast of this program. If you go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, you can, well, let me see. Well, yeah, we got 6 seconds left of Sunday. It was 41 years ago today, September 9th, that John Lennon released Imagine. And as it says on my website, its profoundly radical lyrics make everything else pale by comparison. There's a good video with it. And there's also a new video from the group and the band Pussy Riot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Did you post that on our Facebook page?
I haven't yet, but I will.
Do it. Okay.
Russian punk band.
Yeah, and actually they've got about
a little bit of trouble.
Yeah, three of them have been sentenced to 2 years in jail because they did a little performance inside a church mocking the president of Russia.
And the other two fled the country.
And two members of the band, not the ones that they have in jail. By the way, there's a film coming to our area called Detropia.
I really want to see this.
Yeah. And I interviewed Heidi Ewing, who's from the area, and at 1 a.m. she's going to discuss her film with me. And in many ways, it's kind of a dreary look at our city, although she tries at the end to kind of pull it out.
Yeah. Well, good.
Also, Ernest Drucker, who wrote a book called A Plague of Prisons, and a weird subtitle, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America, says that, you know, that we've got more people percentage-wise and absolutely in prison than any other country in the world, and has no effect on crime reduction, and in fact may increase it.
And so filled with, people on drug charges. And
most of them are nonviolent offenders.
Right.
And they're clients for the prison industrial complex.
Yeah, they love it. Keep doing it. We need to fill these prisons.
313-298-WRIF. You can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall. Peter Werbe and Jalene Jordan here with you. Oh, yeah, we were going to tell you about this couple in Hazel Park. Two women, a lesbian couple, already battling the state's ban on adoptions by unmarried couples. And they, you know, here, that's a what so-called catch-22. Yeah. They can't get married because they're two women, and they have, there is a prohibition in the Michigan Constitution. How disgraceful.
I know.
That says, defines marriage as between a man and a woman. Well, April DeBoer and Jane Rowe, they have three special needs children.
They
adopted.
Yes.
They adopted. And these are kids who probably no one else would have adopted.
I know.
Yeah.
And they're just little precious little things.
And these women take on this challenge. And these cold-hearted conservatives want to keep them apart. So the suit claims that the governor and the attorney general and Oakland County clerk are denying them the same constitutional rights afforded to heterosexual couples. That's true on the face of it. So how are they going to get out of it? I mean, you have a constitution, as I was saying earlier, that calls for due process. I mean, before you can deprive anybody of any right.
Mm-hmm.
And they're deprived at least 100 different benefits that accrue to married couples. And also, hey, here's the big stickler, equal protection under the law. So whatever your personal opinion is about gay marriage, it doesn't matter.
You're just saying these people aren't whole people. It was kind of like back when slaves were only considered three-fifths of a human being. I mean, that is an atrocity.
And the conservatives supported that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as I said earlier, I've always for years now been saying, could you please name for me one point in American history where the conservatives were on the right side of history?
No one can ever do it. We've been asking this for years.
Yeah. And also, maybe the other, what's the Mitt Romney program for jobs?
Yeah. Please tell us that. Yeah. No one can ever do it, Peter. Amazing.
Yeah. All right. Let's get, we were saying that there is no women calling the show, and Joni from Plymouth has answered the call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, you guys.
Joni, my sister, thank you.
Yes, We are sisters. Even Peter.
Okay.
He's the ultimate feminist, the end product of evolution.
He is a feminist.
Awesome end product of evolution.
Yeah. Yes.
So what's up, Joni?
Okay. Well, you know, have you ever heard of the Freedom from Religion Foundation?
Absolutely.
Never heard of it.
FFRF.org.
We're both members.
Okay. Well, so am I. My heart.
See, we are sisters.
Yeah, we are. You have no idea who I am. I will meet you in the future, but we're having fun right now.
You will? Okay.
Okay. would I be surprised when I find out who you are?
Absolutely.
Or would I be surprised?
Would you?
Oh, yeah.
Would you relate it in an email to us?
Oh, it'd be more than that, believe me.
This is so cryptic. I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah. Well, if you feel the
mood. Are we going to like it?
Call.
Oh, you'll love it.
Okay, good.
Call talkyes at yahoo.com for you and anyone else. But go ahead, Joni. What's up?
There was one moment during the convention, the Democratic convention, although I had to force myself to watch the other one, too, where my heart just leapt out because God was not in the platform.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and then they put him back in.
Oh.
You know who that was? Dear Representative Sander Levin.
Yeah.
And he also intervened. He makes the Democratic Party intervene in the peace process between the Palestinians and Israel by having
Jerusalem
the Democratic
back in the platform to make Israel political football.
Yeah, okay. Having Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which is something that the government under Bush, under Obama, under Clinton, under George Bush's father said, this is something that's worked out when there's a peace, there's a final peace
treaty.
Thank you, or
you're
whatever.
Welcome.
Yeah. Now, I, of the Democrats who just every time I hear their name makes my lip curl. Old Sandy Levin is right up there. He used to be my representative. I'm so glad he is not mine anymore. Because, I mean, I would have voted for the Greens. I've never voted for him ever.
Okay. Well. You know, I just want to throw that out there. It was a good moment, and then they put him back. I don't want God on my money either.
Well, they've gone around the block with that one, and it's probably going to stay there. And now the Republicans are saying they're trying to take God off everything. They want to take God off our money and all that.
Yeah, well, it's called the separation of church and state, you chumps.
Yes. All right, Joni, we're looking forward to the big surprise. Thank you, Joni. All right, and let's see. Here is Linda in Newport. Linda, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, another sister.
Hi.
Hi.
I don't know if I'm much of a lady. I think of myself more as an aging tomboy.
Okay, tomboys are cool. I'm a bit of a tomboy here and there.
I am married. I'm not a lesbian. I just wanted to toss this one in the air because I've noticed the Republicans are really making a try for this one, unlike 08. So I think the president hasn't done that bad a job. Now, in 08, they picked Grandpa McCain and Pitbull Palin.
Oh, God.
Where is that whack job? She didn't even get invited, I don't think, to the... She and Bush, they said...
Like,
they're,
go
yeah,
away.
Just go away. Imagine they have a president for 8 years, and he's not even at the convention. That's amazing.
I can imagine it.
And how long has it been since Clinton was in office and he was at the convention?
Right.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say was... Barack can't be doing that bad a job because Republicans like to go for it when things are fixed. Like Reagan and the hostage situation.
Yeah,
W taking over after Clinton balanced the budget.
Right.
Yeah.
So he must be doing a good job.
Well, that's a bit of logic. We'll
take that into consideration.
Thank you, Linda. Appreciate it. Thank you, John, for looking up this quote. I was saying that the Republicans want to suppress the vote because they know they'll do better. Paul Weyrich, who is the, sort of the grandfather of one of the grandfathers of the modern right-wing Republicans, said Christians. He was talking to a Christian group, and I've heard this. I've heard this cut. Christians have goo-goo syndrome, he said, which stands for good government. They want more people to vote. Weyrich says, though, conservative candidates are more likely to win if voting totals go down, which is why they're trying to suppress the vote. Okay, 313-298-WRIF, and let's grab our next caller, which is right here. It's Dan in Mount Clemens. Hi, Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
We're good.
Good.
Yeah, I was wondering, you know, with Clint Eastwood at the Republican convention.
Yes.
You know, most people, I just wondered if he might be mentally ill because
I wondered the same thing. Or, you know, like because some kind of an Alzheimer's thing going on. I think you're right.
Right, because I talk to people, not chairs.
Yeah, well, it was a little stunt, but I don't know if you heard me earlier.
It's his radio.
Yeah, that I said.
By the way, Peter.
What?
I think his radio's up.
No, well,
no. Oh, there would
all
be
right.
a delay.
Are we on the air?
What is going on here?
Never mind. Don't worry. I've got you faded down because we're kind of going to, but I'll let you talk just a second. No, I said a little earlier, Bill Maher said right after the convention that he encapsulated the Republican Party. It was an old white man talking to a man that isn't there. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Did you hear that feedback?
Yeah, I don't know what's causing
that. That was weird.
Yeah. Here's Tim in Birmingham. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How you guys doing tonight?
We're good.
Hi, Tim.
Good. Hey, listen, I was just doing the dishes, listening to your program, RAF. I haven't been listening to your station since Arthur P.
Oh.
And, of course, the old Alan Stagg, Dr. Cosmo stays at WABX. But I got to tell you guys, I'm a little, you know, I listened to your spiel here with the with your young listeners here. And, of course, I was one of them at one time. And you know, you are talking about the Republican Party. I listened to that one gentleman calling earlier. And he was talking about Ronald Reagan, and he made a lot of sense, and yet you guys just seemed to shut him down.
Us?
Yeah, I was quite
no.
surprised that you guys were that you know unwilling to listen to him. But anyways, and of course the John Lennon deal and the all that. But
did you like the song?
Mentioned that that Paul Ryan, of course, and Romney have no agenda or no program to, but they do. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you've heard, but they do have a plan, and a very good plan, to bring us out of this semi-depression that we were in right now. And of course, you know, and I know you've got a lot of young listeners, and I know they're out there wondering, you know, why they're, you know, not able to find the jobs. And the economy, you know, as we know, the economy is in a really bad situation right now, and the unemployment is skyrocketing.
Oh, wait, Tim, let me just say that there is the Ryan plan, I mean, without a doubt, which would be, I think, if anything near it ever got put into practice, it would really sink the country. It essentially, it gives trillions of dollars to the Pentagon that they don't want. It cuts, it cuts benefits for people that can least afford to take them. It's you know, we have Romney saying that Russia is our main enemy.
Please.
You know, these guys are
they're warmongering.
They're a sandwich short of a picnic.
Didn't he say that? I never heard that. I never heard Romney say anything about Russia like that.
No, you got.
He did.
I mean,
it's out there.
He did. Okay, that's amazing. He said that Romney said that Russia was our main enemy. That's astounding. I haven't heard that.
It's true.
All right, we will now put John Miller on the job.
John, find
that
us.
Quote. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me ask.
Please.
Can I say something here once, just to your young listeners?
Yeah. Are you
listen? We are. I feel for the young people of this country today because of the debt and the burden that we have put on them. I don't care about Republican. They have screwed up royally. The Democrats have screwed up royally. We're the young people, my kids, my grandchildren, are going to suffer under the debt that we have put on, the $16-plus trillion borrowing money from the Chinese. When my kids graduate from college, they are going to be paying 50-60% in taxes, federal taxes. I'm not into socializing, let's say, or growing the government to take over the auto industry, the banking industry, the student loans, the EPA, the whole – listen –
what about all the people who would have lost their jobs if the auto industry had gone down? Answer me that.
Part of the problem, do answer her question. But part of the problem is if they hadn't have done all this, this didn't happen overnight. It wasn't just all of a sudden bad luck on the part of George Bush. These were policies that were 30 years in the making. You know, Clinton signed off on some of these bills that allowed, you know, this housing bubble to investment, overvaluation of the market to take place. Yeah. And what have you. And as, you know, as Clinton said, and like we said earlier, we're not big fans of Clinton, that this is nothing that he could have solved. He left office with a surplus, and immediately that was all spent, and we were driven into debt and into poverty by the policies of George W. Bush and the ones that Reagan and Ryan Romney. I know. I got a block on this guy. Romney and Ryan
really
are
do.
Proposing are essentially more the same. It's more of this, you know, what Clinton correctly called trickle-down economics, and it don't work. I mean, I agree with you that
both sides have done horrible things.
Yeah. Without a doubt.
Bill Clinton left office with a surplus because in his second term he had Newt Gingrich and the Republican Congress that held his feet to the fire with the Contract for America. He also took money from Medicare and pushed it over into the general fund to make it look like we had a surplus when indeed we did not.
Well, wait a minute. Now the contract
we call it
the Contract on America, and that was in 1994. That got blown away. People didn't want that, didn't buy it. And, but for one thing, let me tell you this. We could probably go forever who's to blame
worse.
And who's not. But in the long run, the policies that had been acted out, beginning with Reagan, were to smash the New Deal, which meant one of the things wound up to erode and now is threatening to destroy the middle class, because there wasn't a middle class before FDR. There wasn't a minimum wage. There wasn't Social Security. There wasn't, you get into the 60s, Medicare,
and on.
And the Republicans were opposed to every bit of that. And what this was like a 30-year window of prosperity, and Reaganomics is all about, recompressing what it is so that there's just this 1% at the top, this little stream of people that live in Birmingham, and then the rest of us are going to be the peasants.
I'm not sure if I'm on mute or not, but when Ronald Reagan won in a landslide election against Jimmy Carter, who had 22% interest rates, we had gas lines, we had a lot of problems under Jimmy Carter. Ronald Reagan came in, he cut taxes, and that stimulated the economy. You understand? The less people have to pay to the government, we have money to spend in the economy.
Well, wait a minute. He was, what he did, I don't know how much more we can go on with this, but what he did was to cut taxes, on the wealthy. This is the trickle down. And you got to remember too that the economy under Reagan went in the toilet for the longest time, and he spent these trillions on getting us into debt. He increased the debt absolutely incredibly. Now, Obama is stuck with the results of 30 years of Reaganomics, and we got guys that want to do that all over again.
And
all right, thank you.
We predicted all of this when Iraq, just even when it started, right, Peter?
Sure.
And I always made the statement that, this isn't going to be fixed, not even close to it, when, if I had kids, if I had grandkids, until they're... Maybe not even in their time. I don't know. It's bad.
Got to remember, Clinton's lasting discredit, he signed this bill that repealed this 1930s act that would not allow banks to involve themselves in investments. They had to have the separation. Well, that opened the whole door to this casino economy. That wound up with overvaluing all the bad loans, overvaluing the stocks that were there. And then, so whatever, however the surplus was accomplished, it was accomplished. Bush comes in, he starts two wars based on lies.
Right.
Right? And we're still not out of one of them. He cuts taxes on the wealthy because what was going to happen is, that just as you said, Tim, this was going to provide more money for the job creators. Well, it didn't do that at all. All it did was two things. It enriched the already wealthy, and it increased, it accelerated the speculative capital. That is to say, people just investing it. So it wasn't about producing anything. And we're producing less and less.
It was a crapshoot.
Yeah. We're producing less and less, and the wealthier get, their wealth expands because the stock market expands. So there's not even any real there. What's the other part of it? Oh yeah, cuts taxes on the, that doesn't, happen. And, there's another part of this puzzle.
Medicaid?
I don't know. That's enough.
Yeah, moving right along.
Moving. Hey, and Tim was concerned about you young people, as he put it. Any comment from any of you all?
And you know what?
What are you facing?
We have a pretty wide age range of people listening to us. We don't just have the young Riff listener listening to us.
And there was, I thought, a note of condescension there.
I did too. Like you,
you young people don't know at all.
Right.
Well, you don't, and I don't. I mean, that's why we do this together.
Who does?
Yeah. Well, let's see if Fred in Detroit does. Hey, Fred, you're on the air.
Hi, Jolene, Peter.
Hi,
Fred. Help us out, baby.
Well, I think that Art and Tim, they got this white man's burden thing going.
Yeah.
And they forget that in American history, many of their conservative heroes have, through their policies, condone the suppression and even violence toward women and minorities in this country.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And as for Ronald Reagan, for instance, I mean, remember this guy made a huge denouncement of the very Medicare that helped all of these white middle class folks right before LBJ could sign it.
Sure.
But then in 80, he came along with the whole shabby welfare queen argument.
Which was a racist, one of the, what they call the dog whistle of racist politics. You can't hear it, overtly, but the dogs can.
Yeah.
Exactly.
With apologies to all the dogs and dog lovers.
I love that.
And then the whole Iran-Contra thing. Yeah. And then he had to raise taxes after cutting taxes. Because he did dig such a deep hole in the economy.
That's right. I forgot about that. That's why, we need everybody. How about this? John just found this out for us. Under Clinton, the debt grew. People are going to go, see? The debt grew by 43%, right? Mm-hmm. Under Reagan, it grew by 187%.
Thank you. Let's, you can't argue with facts and numbers, right?
Right.
Now, on that note, I wanted to say about the convention.
Yeah, sure.
I didn't care to watch the Republicans. I did watch the Democrats, most of it. And I will say that I was happy with the fact that they could counter, and I mean actually answer, a lot of the accusations and BS that the Republicans laid out against them in their convention. Point to point.
You got it. All right, Fred. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
some open
Fred.
Lines now. 313-298-WRIF. I'm always surprised. There may be, sometimes I think everyone agrees with me other than Tim and Art, but that was about like economics and what have you. But I was making this distinction about marriage equality, that the political state, the state of Michigan, the county of Oakland or Macomb or Wayne or wherever, Lenawee, wherever you're located, is forbidden by the U.S. Constitution to discriminate. Religions can do whatever the hell they want. You know, something like the Mormon Church didn't recognize, they said that black people were, I don't know, something less than human up until 1974.
I mean, God, that is just...
Well, they actually have said that they've actually
that
said
was
that
wrong.
Was wrong. Yeah, yeah.
Well,
so,
good.
Yeah, yeah. So, But so they can do their little diddly thing, whatever they want. But the political state can't. And it doesn't matter whether any individual thinks that their opinion, they don't like it, or they think this, or they think that. That's not the question. The question is a matter of constitutional law. So you can't both be these right-wingers who are always talking about the Constitution and then deny people what is guaranteed inside of the Constitution.
How do they get away with that?
Yeah. What I like, too, the Constitution begins with the phrase, provide for the common welfare.
The people.
Yeah. All right, let's go on here. I want to get Mo. I get what you're saying, Mo, but say it for us. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, Peter. Hello.
Oh, Julie. Detroit, Maurice.
Maurice, where have you been?
Driving a cab.
Have nothing to say.
You nothing. Okay. Well,
when did this ever happen?
We're shocked.
I'm
going
to piss off a lot of people again.
Uh-oh.
You know what? The elections is a joke.
Why do you think?
Okay. Look how much money do you think the president make a year?
I forgot what it is.
Couple hundred thousand,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
$250
Now, he's in charge of a country, right?
That's right.
You take a smaller CEO of a Fortune 500 company, they make
millions.
They bonus.
In bonuses alone.
Bonuses, they are what you call expensive vouchers. And you know what? I put it like this. The president is picked for you before you even vote for.
He's picked for
you. All that protest that King did back in the 60s, we would have eventually got our rights. People, we would have eventually got our rights. We might have took a little bit longer. Look how long it took the Berlin Wall to fall.
What?
Eventually, things
the Berlin Wall.
Keep on.
Oh, Berlin Wall. Okay.
Yeah. Now, I'm saying, how people protest against things, but eventually things will fall to this wall. Things this wall is not going to last forever.
Yeah, they can't.
They have to be right some way.
Yep, they can't last forever. You're right.
They can't. But a lot of these people trying to hold on all they can. Well, Maurice, don't be a stranger. Thank you again. Appreciate it.
See, he, unlike us, if he doesn't have anything to say, doesn't say anything.
Okay, well, we're paid to, regardless.
Right.
Speaking of all that money that makes these elections go on, and the fact that some of these he could wind up with criminal indictment, Sheldon Adelman from Las Vegas, pumping $100 million of his own money
into the Republican
billionaire industrialist David Koch, who's steering millions of dollars to elect Mitt Romney as well. Did you see you didn't see that. Romney walked off the stage and, he walked by all the delegates, you know, and he very stiffly, and then he saw David Koch from the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H, and gave him a hug.
Probably kissed him.
Kissed him, yeah. Koch, though, he disagrees with the Republican stance on gay marriage, and
I was surprised by that.
Yeah. Well, he's a libertarian. Right. He ran on the Libertarian ticket for 1980, as the presidential candidate. And also, these Libertarians, you know, they're the, if you would, almost the left wing of the Republicans.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw a bunch of libertarians one time. I might have told you this. And one, I was talking to this very attractive woman, and she said something to me. And I said, libertarians, she's very little, just like an inch or two closer than you would be if you
like your personal space.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I said to her, libertarians are just Republicans who want to smoke dope. She said, we're Republicans who want to have sex.
She did?
Yeah.
God, Peter.
And had, what is it?
You lady killer.
CFE. You know what that is?
Oh,
No.
M.
Wait a minute.
Shoes?
Never mind. I can't. Oh, yeah, CFM.
Come on, right. I know. I have a bunch of them.
CFM, eyes. CFM, eyes.
I just never wear them to work.
Yeah, right. That's good. Well, I'm glad. I don't like to be distracted.
I don't like to distract you.
I don't want to be distracted. Isn't that a song by the Ramones? I want to be distracted.
Sedated.
Sedated. Okay. Here's William and Taylor. William, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how's it going, guys?
Going good.
Great. How are you?
I'm doing quite well, thank you. I wanted to call and really thank you guys for actually talking about things that kind of matter right now, especially in an election year.
You are welcome.
I'm a college student, and it's appalling other people my age that aren't informed, aren't involved, and I'm just glad you guys bring up all the points that we should probably focus on.
Oh, man, we appreciate it. Spread the word about the show. and sure. and spread the word on your campus to these people. You know, I mean,
join us on Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall.
Start a group. Join a group.
One thing, William, there was just an article in the front page of the New York Times how one in six students, or well, graduated students with debt is in default.
I haven't even started with mine.
Well, because, I mean, you know, you rack up a debt of $50,000 and then, you know, you're lucky if you can even find a job in what you're graduating in.
And you know what? It's like they'll allow you to pay $50 a month, right?
I mean, I don't think anymore. They want a little more than that.
For certain amounts, depending up to a certain point. Some people are defaulting on $50 a month.
Wow. In I don't know if you're familiar with this, William, but in Quebec, where there was just an election, that there is a student movement of such magnitude that hundreds of thousands of people, students and, you know, just ordinary people, mm-hmm. protesting the fact that they were trying to raise tuition. And most people in the States haven't even heard of this. But, I mean,
we just bend over and take it here.
Yeah, and whenever he talks about doing some type of reform on student loan rates, they go insane and call it welfare. I mean, I'm a pre-law student. I'm looking at $200,000 next year,
God.
And, I mean, I wanted to thank you for even mentioning our preamble most certainly does mention the fact that we have to provide for common defense and promote general welfare. Yeah. And welfare is used as a dirty word when it is in our preamble to the Constitution. Before the Constitution was written and properly amended and signed, we had that.
And all these people up in arms about welfare are, I think a lot of them are just hateful people and a lot of racists. And Bill Clinton, they should be happy. Bill Clinton kicked half of them off of this.
Yeah, I don't even get it. I mean, there are not able-bodied men on welfare any longer. That hasn't happened in 15 years, probably. You know what I don't understand, though, William? If I was a student right now and facing that kind of debt, I would, you know, there's a small Jubilee movement, which means the forgiving of debt and the fact that we are saddling. I mean, that was one thing that Tim was correct about, but the debt we're talking about is the personal debt that students are taking on. For one thing, there ought to be two movements. One, free university tuition. Why the hell? I mean, you know, we don't pay for high school. Why should we pay for college?
Yeah, and think about the level of education that would rise out of that.
The relief of debt of all student debt, just cancel it all out. Now you'd say, well, whoa, wait a minute. You know, what's that all about? I said one in six students are in default for their. Well, that means five in six aren't. But they're taking a portion of their income and just giving it back to the government. If that money was freed up for, whatever else, anything from entertainment to consumer goods to whatever, that would have a real driver effect on the economy. But so William, I know that law school is real easy. I'm kidding.
Oh, my God.
I'm kidding. Go out and start a student movement, too.
Hey, William.
Yes?
What kind of law are you studying?
I am intending to go into criminal prosecution, but I currently focus on public policy because I'm appalled by our current political atmosphere. And
you
I
should
attempt
stay
to
with public policy.
Educate.
Yeah, we got a lot of prosecutors. All right, William, I got to take a break now. So thank you very much. I appreciate it. And, call in again. John writes, loophole, this is our producer, a loophole in loan repayment. You can submit $0 payments to avoid default.
You can't?
I mean, what does $0 mean?
$0.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah. What do I owe you? $100? Here's nothing. Like, okay, thank you.
It's free in a way.
Yeah. We'll be right back. Hey, it's our final segment, so we'd like to know what you think about the conventions, if you saw any of them. And no one has answered the question, and I think the answer to all is probably no. Did anybody watching get their mind changed because they saw these spectacles?
No, that there was a speech so compelling that it moved you.
The only one I could imagine would be Clinton.
That man can speak. What can I say?
Yeah. All right, we'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Detroit's Rock Station on the web. Thanks for listening to WRIF.com.
Get all of Drew and Mike's best moments delivered right to your computer or mobile device. The Drew and Mike Podcast, brought to you by Matt's Jewelry Brokers. For fast cash, call Matt's at 586-286-2866. Subscribe today at WRIF.com. This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com. is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Give us a call, some open lines. At 1 a.m., I'm going to be interviewing Heidi Ewing. She co-directed Detropia. Detropia. This is a brand new film about our city, a documentary. And sort of ask the question, is Detroit ever going to come back? It's opening in Detroit area theaters on September 14th. It's going to be at the Main in Royal Oak, the Rensen in downtown, and at the Michigan Theater in Ann Arbor.
Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
I want to go see that with you, by the way.
I already saw it. Well, honey, I interviewed her. I had to see it. They give you what they call in the biz a screener.
Bummer.
Yeah.
Do you still have it?
Yeah. So you can watch
okay,
it.
Good.
Let's see. All right. Let's go back to our phones. We're talking about the conventions, but anything is okay. Here's Rico in Farmington Hills. Hey, Rico, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good.
Well, I watched both of the conventions.
Wow.
First of all, well, you know, it was boring, wasn't nothing on. So I watched the Republican convention. It was like watching the Klan have a rally. I was like, Lord, what is going on? Now, we moved on to the Democratic convention. I saw America.
Thank you.
I saw every type of person that you wanted to see that wanted to live in America.
And does live in America.
It was like there was actual diversity.
Yeah, wow.
Well, you know, you can't have diversity unless you got unity and fellowship.
Yeah, right.
So if that's what it's come, this diversity thing, everybody's on the diversity kick. Shoot, Martin Luther King was talking about that a long time ago.
He was.
And now I got questions.
Sure.
What happened when FDR created Social Security and he said nobody was supposed to mess with it, but they went in it anyway? Isn't that against the law?
I don't know how they, you know, they have this whole fund, and then they have, you know, it defies my memory half the time. I forgot. I'm trying to conjure up in my brain what this section of it is that, you know. I don't know. It is stable. Social Security is stable right now. And if to the extent that they can't meet all its obligations, I think in like 20 years or something, all you got to do is take the cap off of the FICA taxes. In other words, right now you make like $108,000 a year, and if you're making $20 million, you just pay on $108,000.
Yeah.
You or me are making $50,000. Well, we got to pay the full thing. So the Koch brothers and the rest of them ought to pay on every dime they make, and then, hey, Social Security would be fine. No problem.
Yeah. Another question is, what happened to all the money that we loaned to all these foreign countries, and they didn't pay us back, told us, you know, kiss our, and then.
Oh, you can say ass. That's all right.
Well, I don't want the FCC coming on y'all.
No, that one's legal.
It's gone. It's gone so far, Rico, you can't believe it.
This is crazy.
Yeah.
And then, every time somebody, I heard an old man say one time, when the Republicans are in there, everybody's poor. But when the Democrats are in there, we make money. So, I mean.
Well, let me see. Is that true? The Depression began because of essentially Republican policies in the 20s. Yeah.
Is money out there, because if it wasn't, all these people that's pouring all these millions into this guy with the stick up his behind, it's crazy.
Well, hey, we're the richest country in the world. How come there's so many poor people?
Yeah, it's
how come any child doesn't? How come any child goes to bed hungry?
They're talking about 60 kids in a class in Detroit?
Yeah, yeah.
It's even out almost in Farmington Hills.
Well, I got to tell you, you know, one of the things, this emergency manager deal, and one of the criticisms that people said is that the emergency the financial situation was only taking a place in cities that were predominantly African American, like Detroit and Flint and Ecorse and Benton Harbor, and empirically, that's the case. It just so happened those were the poorest areas, but now the state has just declared a financial emergency in Allen Park. So it's what's happening here in the wealthiest country in the world. We have cities that are going broke. They can't meet its basic financial obligations. It can't keep first responders on the job. It all has to do is where is the money? And if it's all parked up by the, you know, with the 1%, and they're just trying to get more and more and more, and you have these fools that are going to vote for the people that are committed to it, I don't know what to say about where they're at.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
But I think this Alan Park thing is interesting because what's afoot here with this financial emergency stuff is that they want to destroy the public schools, they want to destroy the teachers' unions, they want to break all the AFSCME unions and drive wages down, and the main thing is they wanted to get rid of these unions because they're the bulwark of the Democratic Party. The Republicans essentially want one-party rule.
Yes.
They loathe the unions.
Yeah. All right, Rico, thank you very much. Appreciate your comments. Rico. Thank you for joining us. And
I think he was a first-time caller.
Was he? Okay, maybe. Here is Pete in Farmington. A little while ago, there was somebody called a man named Art who called in, who was a conservative caller, and I think Pete wants to comment on that. Hi, Pete. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, guys. This is my first time calling.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Anyway, so this guy, Art, he thinks that Reagan just cut taxes and that was that. Well, yeah, he cut taxes to start with, which was a political ploy. Like, hey, I'm saving you money. Vote for me.
Right.
Then, again, like somebody else said, he did have to raise taxes, but he didn't just raise them once. He raised them 11 times.
Yeah, I forget about all this stuff. You're right. You're absolutely right, Pete. Yeah.
A lot of people have been bringing that up lately. It's important.
Yeah.
And you are right. He did explode not just the size of government, but the spending of government from 182 to 187%, depending on who you talk to. And the thing is, that's really odd from a party that says, oh, hey, we believe in small government.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
As I always say, when it's convenient.
Yep. And then they complain about, you know, President Obama spending. Well, guess what? A lot of the spending that was done was mandatory spending. It was stimulus spending. There's the fallout from TARP, ERA, all this other crap. And it's just like, guys, you can say, oh, stop spending money all you want, but guess what happens? You still owe what you owe.
Sure.
We still have loans that are 20-year-old loans, 30-year-old loans. All right? There's no getting around that. Unless, of course, you want us to default, and then we're in a whole different world of hurt.
Well, The only alternative I heard to, like, the TARP, the bailouts of the banks and what have you, was let them go bankrupt. Or
want to talk about unemployment.
Yeah, the only alternative I heard to bailing out the auto industry was, like, what Romney said, let them go bankrupt.
Yeah.
And you know what Romney, he's figuring he's going to, you know, die with that among working people. So apparently what Romney has now shifted his take on him writing that infamous op-ed piece in the New York Times saying let Detroit go bankrupt is he's going to say that money should have best been spent on first responders, you know, keep police and firemen on the job. But that still would have let the auto companies nosedive, right?
Yeah, no, that's not a good plan. I mean, he's the guy that wanted first responders fired, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, he's all about firing and offshoring and all of that, yeah.
And as far as, you know, education goes, you know, people have been complaining about that too. Well, that goes back to the Powell Memorandum from the 70s saying that, oh, you know, people are too friendly with the government when it comes to education, so we need to just start telling people in school that government is bad, 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 bad. You know, government's not good or bad. It's a tool. You maintain it. You work on it. If you don't, if you just ignore it when you need it, it's not there for you. Right?
What amendment did you say?
It's not an amendment. It's the Powell Memorandum. It was a
Powell. Powell was a Supreme Court justice. Yeah, he set the stage for a lot of this. Also, by the way, Powell was this justice, this Republican was a clerk for one of the Supreme Court justices in 1954, and he advised that justice to vote against the Supreme Court decision outlawing segregation.
Brown versus the Speaker Board of Education, right? 1954.
Right.
Equal is inherently unequal.
Are you in law school too?
No. I did a couple tours in Iraq, got out, and then started going to college on the post-9/11 GI Bill. So right now I'm at Michigan studying economics.
That GI Bill, that sounds like socialism to me.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It does, and that's a good thing.
And that is a damn good thing.
All right. Hey, Pete, got a lot of callers and just a few minutes left. So thanks for joining us, and hey, you know what you're talking about, so please call us back.
Yes, please.
Appreciate it. All right, let's get through some...
We don't mind people who don't know what they're talking about either, because it creates fodder.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all right. Let's see. Here is Jason. Jason, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing, Peter? First-time caller?
Yeah, good.
Welcome.
Hi.
You guys were talking about the Social Security and how they rob out of it. I'm a member of a union. We have a multi-employer pension fund.
Right.
And we have to be funded by a certain percentage at a certain time.
Yeah.
And I would just...
I think he just got kind of stage fright.
Oh, okay. Well, you can call back.
Yeah, or call back.
I mean, Right. In this case, we'll allow it.
All right. Here is Ed in Novi. Ed, go ahead. You're on the air.
Evening, Peter. A quick question. If Romney were to win the election, how do you see him with the military spending compared to what we've had with the two prior George Bushes, especially when my concern as a voter is having money in Social Security and Medicare and whatnot, you know, for when I get older, and it's just alarming all the money that gets dumped into military spending. I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, he's not going to hack it in half.
Yeah, in fact, he's going the other way.
Yeah.
He, in fact, is proposing to spend more than the Pentagon
even wants.
Yeah. So that's one of the strong military cut all what they call the entitlements. You know that if you're poor and sick,
you can just die.
Yeah. Well, no, but that would be Medicaid would be an entitlement. How dare you think you should be kept alive by taxpayer money?
Sick? How dare you?
The real question that isn't addressed is why is there 46 million people in this country that need Medicaid? Actually, maybe that sounds low.
Need health insurance?
Yeah, that need like Medicaid or food stamps or, you know, boy, I'm glad when I can't think of their names. Newt Gingrich. He said, you know, that Obama is the food stamp president.
And, God. That's racist there.
But what that masks, of course, is that the economy is collapsing and people
need it.
Yeah. So, I mean, and one of the things, I mean, Obama is certainly, you know, nowhere near like this radical that these idiots are trying to portray him as, and he's never really getting to the nub of it either. I mean, it's a whole way that our economy is structured. I mean, how wealth is distributed. And, you know, we talk about values. What kind of values do we have? I mean, how can we have guys like David Koch who can, or Sheldon Adelson who can spend hundreds of millions of dollars of their own money. And a few blocks from here, people are going through, ash cans for, pop bottles.
Yes. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Something's wrong. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Speaking of David Koch, and I've mentioned this before, about how David Koch is a philanthropist, not a philanderer like a lot of these Republicans are, and Bill Clinton was.
Just politicians.
Yeah. David Koch gives tons of money away.
Kind of all the wrong things.
He essentially paid for the Tea Party movement. That wouldn't be it's not a grassroots movement. He's essentially the
phenom.
No, that's bad. But he also, when you go to Lincoln Center, it says David M. Koch.
He supports the arts.
Yeah.
Right.
What is Center for Performing Arts?
Yeah.
And he had prostate cancer. And contributed like $150 million to prostate cancer research. And when I've talked about this, I've said, so this guy's a multi-billionaire. You know, he's got more money than the state of Michigan. He'd be loved. So a friend of ours in New York City just had a prostate surgery for cancer.
Yeah.
And his surgeon occupied the David M. Koch medical chair.
What?
That, you know, what happens is in universities, wealthy people endow certain positions. So the position that his surgeon has was financed by this David M. Koch. And this friend of mine, of course, is a real lefty.
Yeah.
Just like...
he's like, oh, please, please.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was pretty good. So,
well, you know, people are not 100%. You can't be 100% bad, right?
Some of them are.
Well, yeah, but in the main.
You know, there was another thing, you know, that there's all these movies. Now, this right-wing movie about Obama has just filled with crap-a-roo.
It's filled with a bunch of crap, and it made more money than an Inconvenient Truth.
Well, now it's the number two best-selling.
That's scary.
Yeah. The only other one is Fahrenheit 9/11. Fahrenheit 9/11.
Yeah.
Yeah. The reason that I gave the wrong number, folks, in case you don't know, that is the name of a Ray Bradbury book called Fahrenheit 4. Oh, maybe it's not.
I don't know. I can't remember.
Isn't it Fahrenheit 4/11?
I don't know. John!
John! Yeah. It's, what is that? Because... it's the temperature at which paper burns.
Oh,
that's
I don't know that either.
Now there's this other book, and I don't want to, I never want to promote any of this. That, you know, this stupid movie about Barack Obama. They say that, you know, that he is just driven by these views of his Kenyan father, this post-colonial. You know, he hardly ever saw his father. He left when he was 5, and then he saw him once again when he was 10, and then he died in a car accident, the father did, when he was...
why is anyone even talking about this?
I know. So, but what does that mean to have a Kenyan post-colonial perspective?
Like, what does that mean?
I don't know.
It means the fact that these people even said that are a bunch of racist pigs.
Yeah, and then there's this other thing that's not even his real father. His real father, they said, was this black communist named...
Where is it?
I looked up this guy. He's worth doing. Oh, no, I can't find his name. Oh, Frank Marshall Davis.
Okay.
Yeah, who seems like a pretty cool guy. All right, that does it for us, but not for me.
No.
Because I am going to be...
can never get enough of you.
Moving along for another hour. Going to be interviewing Heidi Ewing, the co-director of Detropia, a new film about Detroit opening soon in our city. Mm-hmm. And then also about prisons. Ernest Drucker has written a book about prisons saying, contrary to incarceration being part of what reduces crime, it may in fact...
increasing.
Elevated. Thank you. I was just
I'm here to help. Here to help.
And so is John Miller. Thank you, John. Thank you. You're great back there helping us.
Thanks to everyone for calling.
We know what the hell we're talking about. And in about 11 hours, if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com.
Or our Facebook page, I will be posting it.
Okay. That's Facebook.com/Night Call or WRIF.com.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
What?
WRIF's Rocktoberfest is back. Saturday, September 22nd. Simple alert selection of craft and specialty Oktoberfest beers, plus delicious food from German to barbecue. Live bands all day in the beer garden. Football on the big screens in the sports den. Fun in the Rift Mancard Village, including mechanical bull, high strike game, the big tug competition, and much more. A portion of the proceeds benefit the Penrickton School for the Blind and Taylor. Details at WRIF.com. September 22nd at Heritage Park in Taylor. The Rift's third annual Rocktoberfest. Presented by Budweiser. Great times are waiting. Grab some buds. And 101 WRIF. Everything battering rocks. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Rift's third annual Rocktoberfest. September 22nd at Heritage Park in Taylor. More details at WRIF.com. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. About 5 or 6 years ago, I interviewed Heidi Ewing. She's from the Detroit area, and she and Rachel Grady have formed Loki Films. It's a nonfiction film production company, and they founded it in 2001, and they've done incredible films since its founding. Their film, Jesus Camp, and that's the one I interviewed Heidi Ewing about, was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature
in 2007. She's done 12th, they, I should say, 12th in Delaware, which was in competition at the Sundance Film Festival. That was in 2010. And it was a collaboration with HBO, and it takes a look at the raging abortion battle in America. So these two are right on top of all of the issues. Actually, I would probably could go on with the kind of film credits they had. They were nominated for an Emmy for The Boys of Baraka, a film about preteens struggling to make it in Baltimore. But now a new film has come our way by Rachel Grady and Heidi Ewing. It's called Detropia, and we'll get to what that title is all about. But in there you sense exactly the name of our city, Detroit. And, you know, there are utopias and there are dystopias. This is Detropia. It's a pleasure to welcome back Heidi Ewing. Heidi, welcome back to your hometown, right?
Oh, it's such a pleasure to hear you once again after all these years. Thank you for having me.
It has been a while, but we are doing it again. So you've made films about Baltimore. You've made films about Jesus Camp. Suddenly it's one about our town. What was what gave you the impetus to do it?
Well, you know, I wanted to test the idea that you can't come home again. You know, you can't go home again. So we wanted to put that to cinematic test. I mean, you know, there's never been a desire previously to tackle something, you know, close to home or close to my heart. It happened organically, you know, coming home in 2008 and early 2009, things really seemed to be a lot of anxiety in the area, and the job reports in Michigan were abysmal. And obviously the financial crisis affected so many people, but it really started to affect people that I knew, and some of my friends from high school had left. And so one starts asking the question, well, what happened here, and what's next for this area and for Detroit? And so it was a conversation that started between my co-directing partner and myself, Rachel, around here at the office. And in October 2009, we decided to come to Detroit for 4 days on an exploratory mission with our cameraman and just see what we found. And after those 4 days, we just looked at each other and we said, we need to make a film about Detroit. We don't know what it is. We don't know what we have in mind. We don't know where it will lead us, but there's an important story to be told here. Let's find it. And we set about raising the money and getting the Ford Foundation and people involved, and basically in September 2010, moved to downtown Detroit, where we spent more than a year on the ground filming, and that became Detropia.
Heidi Ewing, you are from the Detroit area, but many of us, of course, I mean, you were, as I remember, born and raised in the suburbs, so it's Detroit is so close and yet so far. So what was it like coming to literally another city?
Well, you know, there's so much familiar. I had a memory in a lot of different corners. My grandmother, you know, lived near 7 Mile in Livernois, and my parents were raised in the city. They did leave after the riot, so I was raised, you know, on 12 Mile Road. But we did always maintain contact with the city. I went to Mercy High School, but all my boyfriends went to UD High School in Detroit, where my father had gone to school, and there was a contact, you know, often. But of course, it wasn't my town. I could leave, and I would go home, and I wasn't a city dweller. So there was always a little bit of that distance. So really, I kind of relished the opportunity once and for all to move and live in Detroit. And I was so, it was such a pleasure to have the opportunity to do that, and not, you know, just be shuttling back and forth like I did. But I do feel a kinship, and I felt sort of like an insider-outsider, and I guess that's kind of how I guess I am an insider-outsider, maybe more of an outsider, but I definitely have a feel of warmth for the place that maybe someone who's not from the area would not feel.
Tell us about the title, Detropia. Obviously, the first syllable is about Detroit, and then I said at the beginning there are utopias and dystopias. Why the film title?
You know, we couldn't figure out a title. It was one of those things where nothing really fit, and we tried so many different things, and they all just rang untrue or hollow or cliche. And one night, you know, in the edit room, we were watching the material, and we have a shot in the film where a guy is walking past a former auto parts shop, and an artist who's has clearly changed the letters. It's on Michigan Avenue, and they changed the letters to read Utopia. out of the words auto parts. They added some letters and took some away. And I just loved the image. And we have the shot in our film. And we started playing around with the concept that Detroit, to so many, was this utopian dream in terms of the middle class with, you know, millions of people coming from the South to you know, have a job in manufacturing and to buy the house and the car and make a better life for themselves and their kids. So in so many ways, Detroit has represented a utopia and really really delivered on that for a lot of people. And I think there has been a slide, as we all know, in the last several years. And some could say there is a dystopian element to the life for some in Detroit. So really it's kind of up to the audience, but the initial inspiration was the word utopia, not dystopia.
Mm-hmm. Well, all documentaries have talking heads in it, but I should say, having just seen a preview screening of it last night, that this is a film whose cinematic values are extraordinary. There's a lot of periods in it where it's just almost
wordless
and dreamy, and there's not a narrator. Not a narrator.
No.
There once in a while is a few titles, like saying in 1930 Detroit was the fastest, I didn't know, this fastest growing city in the world.
In the world.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, and the film, though, like all documentaries and all of, I guess, of reality, always strikes me like the parable of the blind man and the elephant. That is, one blind man grabs the elephant's tail and says, an elephant is like a snake. Another one grabs its leg and says, oh, no, it's like a tree. Another one grabs its trunk and says, so how does one, in an hour and a little more than an hour and a half, like in Detropia, your film, how does one grasp something so complex as the city of Detroit?
One cannot grasp the complexity of the city of Detroit. Detroit requires 20 or 30 films, and there have been other films being made in and around the city, and I'm happy for that because, of course, we wouldn't want the burden of pretending or deluding ourselves that we have told the entire story. It's not possible, and we knew it would never be possible. So Detropia is really a rendering. It's our experience. It's our view, and who we sort of fell in love with along the way in Detroit. You know, it's just documentary film is a series of omissions. It just is. And you really, so much more gets left out than gets included. And at some point you have to sort of accept that and just tell the story that you can tell in the best way, in the most truthful way you can tell it. So it's definitely not a complete picture. For us, the film is, I would say, that it focuses on a handful of Detroiters who have chosen to stay despite some of the challenges that they face. Our film is mostly from the perspective of African Americans living in Detroit, for the most part, with some other players coming in and out. It's really more about lifers, I guess. I guess that's where we ended up, and it wasn't that we set out to do so. One of our subjects is a business owner, Mr. Stevens, who is trying to keep a blues bar open in the east side of Detroit. Another one is a wonderful young blogger and barista who's got a lot of hope for the future of Detroit, but also is definitely interested and a little bit obsessed with the past greatness of the city. And we have, of course, we have George McGregor at Local 22, who's very concerned about the shrinking middle class and the gutted manufacturing base in this country. And so these are the people that mostly we rest the film on. But like you mentioned, the city itself becomes a character, and there's a lot of wordless sections, and there's also interactions at the Opera House and with scrappers that we ran across in the middle of the night. And there's just other players. It's really a chorus of voices. And so, no, it is not a complete picture, but we feel that it is a picture, and it is a Detroit that a lot of people experience and live every day.
My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Heidi Ewing. She and Rachel Grady have co-directed and co-produced Detropia, and we need to maybe give you a little bit of spelling on that so you can look it up. It's Detropia. You can also go to my website, peterwerbe.com, or you can go to, if you got the spelling, I hope you did, I know many of you in your cars, detropia.com, or just write me at Peter, P. Werbe at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That will do it. Well, let's You know, one thing that sort of threw me for a loop. Well, actually, let me. You just mentioned that it focuses on African Americans. That almost seemed incidental. I mean, these really came forth as just full human beings struggling in a bad situation. I mean, certainly the UAW Local 22 that George McGregor headed was this integrated local until, you know, the American Gear and Axle just sent all of its work to Mexico. And Mr. Stevens at the Raven Lounge, that's a beautifully integrated, I don't know, I mean, I know people that go there, people from the suburbs.
Sure. How do you really?
Yeah. Well, I went. Yeah, in the film, I know it. I said, "Gee, everybody there is African American." But well, whatever. I mean, sure, we, you know, that people in this country are so race conscious, but ultimately, it just seemed like a story about human beings trying
exactly.
to make
it,
do.
It, you're right. It is incidental that the subjects, most of the subjects of the films are African American. It just. Turned out that way, but of course these are people who. What's more important is their story, is their struggle, is their hope, and their thoughts about the future of the city. Of course,
you know, one thing that threw me for a loop. I told you I was going to ask you this. Is that you listed in the credits a consultant as Nolan Finley, who's who's the editorial page director of the Detroit News,
right.
Who is a very, very, very conservative man.
I know. But
who would probably blame?
Doesn't he?
But the what? Sorry, what?
He's got quite the reputation.
Yeah, he probably would say that it's like Local 22 and the UAW that drove American Gear and Axle out of Detroit because of their unreasonable wage demands. And when you see this film, Detropia, and see, I don't know, I think we could give a little way when they talked about a living wage. Could, in answering about Nolan Finley, could you relate just that little section of the film too, and the answer from the company?
No, Nolan Finley and I do not share the same politics and the same view. And that's great. I like to argue with people, and he was helpful to me in the production, in the sense of, you know, we would sit together every once in a while, have a coffee, and debate things, and I would get his perspective, and then I would call my old friend Stephen Henderson, who I've known since high school, who's the editorial page writer of the Free Press, and we would chew on things, and he'd give me his perspective, and, you know, Nolan helped in the sense of, you know, he knew some of the old barkeeps and some of the old characters that I was looking for early on in the film, and he would say, hey, have you gone over to Honest John's, and have you met the people, and have you gone to the Ivanhoe, and have you gone here and there, and he just sort of gave me sort of like his perspective on some things maybe not to miss. None of them were political in nature, and you know, he made an effort to help out where he could, and you know, he was helpful to me in the early stages, and so
okay.
I had no problem putting him down as a consultant, but it by no means, of course, means that this film is through his perspective, because clearly it's not. I mean, there's
no,
a lot of
it's
things
not.
In the film that would take issue with. But I've also known him for a long time. His mother, I knew his mother very well.
Oh.
So it's, you know, it goes back to some of the roots that I had. And I actually didn't realize he was as controversial a figure.
Oh, I actually
was making the film, and I was like, man, you really ruffle a lot of feathers. You know, I hadn't been in the city in so long, I didn't realize that he really is such a polarizing figure. But he was helpful in the early stages of the process.
Well, I've even at public forums where he and I have been on the same panel, sparks flew. So I would volunteer for if you do Detropia 2 to be your consultant.
Okay.
Heidi Ewing's my guest. The film is Detropia. Well, you know what? We're remiss. You should keep reminding me of this, that the film is going to open very soon, Friday, September 14th. At the Rensen Theater, at the main theater in Royal Oak, and also at what theater in Ann Arbor?
The Michigan Theater in Ann Arbor.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and we'll be, the opening weekend, we'll be at all the different cinemas, making different appearances, doing Q&As, and I'm really looking forward to, you know, hearing people's perspectives and getting a conversation going.
You know, how do you react to some of the criticisms of the film that said it was in, I want to explain this word, ruin porn, that R-U-I-N porn, that is that it only showed a devastated Detroit, and some people said, hey, there's great things going on in Detroit, and people are rebuilding, and there's urban gardens, and there's new housing developments, but that was it. They said that you only showed the bad, a sympathetic, but only the bad side of Detroit.
Oh, I wholeheartedly disagree with that interpretation. Most of the critics that I've read, I can tell you for a fact, have not seen the film. That does not mean that people who see the film won't criticize it, and that's fine too. I much prefer a criticism when someone has seen the film. So trailers or excerpts and things like that really don't do justice. That's for one. Now, number two, you know what? I just feel like there's so much optimism and hope in all of our main subjects, and Detroit overall, for a great number of people, is a difficult place to live. If you don't have a car, like half of Detroiters do not own a car, I believe the number. If you don't, you know, have access to the bus system, if you don't have access to the resources to buy a new home, I don't want to gloss over, some of the challenges that great many Detroiters face. So for us, it really wasn't doing a great service to the city to only focus on the arrival of the creative class or to only focus on, you know, the goings on at the Avalon Bakery or Slow's Barbecue. I feel like there's a lot of coverage, and rightfully so, has been given to the renewal, and with the M&M commercial and Clint Eastwood and the whole country talking about Detroit. I think that there's a lot of other voices, and there's other coverage that is very well handling that aspect. And what we sort of ended up gravitating to were just, you know, regular people that love Detroit and would like some changes to be made or hope for a more functional place. And so, you know, for us, it is a sympathetic portrait, and most people who've seen the film who are not from the area just comment on how beautiful it looks, and how mysterious and how majestic and magical. So it's a funny thing. I mean, we've been showing the film for 6 months at film festivals while we're, you know, trying to get ready for the release and raise the money and all of that, and it really breaks down by generation. You have people in their 20s and early 30s who will wait around after a Q&A, after a film festival, to talk to us and say, I want to move to Detroit. How do I move to Detroit? Where should I live in Detroit? Can you give me your card so I can email you? Because I'm going to move there because I see these artists moving in, because I see opportunity, because I can afford it, because I'm a college graduate with no job, but a place like Detroit I can afford and I could thrive. You've got older people who have a reaction that's more like, wow, this country's really, really in trouble. Our cities are failing. Our cities are going bankrupt. My city also is experiencing what Detroit is. So I really see the reaction to the film breaking down by generation so far. And I find that very, very interesting. I think that there are multiple Americas, but the America that young people are living in, a place like Detroit, you know, even with its troubles, looks like a place that they'd like to migrate to. So, you know, I don't get the feeling from my viewers so far that it's some kind of turnoff, despite, you know, some of the difficulties we do show. So we'll have to see. I mean, you know, Detroiters are defensive by nature about their city. I understand that. I grew up there. They don't want to be kicked around. And but I think that most people will find that the film is really not just about Detroit, but it's about this country as a whole taking some collective decisions about where we're going to go as a nation. And I do think by the end of the film, really, it's about all of us. And I really hope that that's the takeaway.
Well, I it was with me. I mean, I had heard some of the criticisms ahead of time, and I was sort of prepared for that. But I thought, ultimately, it was an accurate portrayal. And as a filmmaker, I think you'll probably appreciate my response that when the UAW Local 22 was dealing with the fact that American Gear and Axle was essentially blackmailing these workers into taking substandard wages, or they were going to move their plant to Mexico, which they did anyway, I was almost in tears. I mean, you know, I wasn't weeping, but I could, you know, the humiliation that these men and women were being confronted with, and essentially the unraveling of their lives, is so extraordinarily powerful. And I love all of the new, as you said, you know, the creative class. My niece was here visiting. She lives in New York City. City, and she said she'd never been in Detroit. She said, "Oh, I want to move here." So
yeah,
that's
it.
But I don't think that you know, the Avalon Bakery, who, you know, I know the owners, and Slow's Barbecue, and artists, and essentially what I call the hip-wazee, can replace a tax base that's necessary. That, like, when you have big manufacturing and the small businessmen, like Mr. Stevens at the Raven Lounge. So that you're I think your film is dead on. And
really,
and beautifully done.
Saying that, I mean, you can't, you know, hey, you want young businesses, you want, you know, you want the coffee shop, the Astro Coffee Shop, but we know how many coffee cups would it take for a full recovery of a place like Detroit? Like, let's be real. Let's talk about the massive, massive outsourcing. Let's talk about trying to bring corporate America to the table and have a discussion, a human discussion about what we can do with this, the low-skilled and unskilled labor that really has no place in this economy anymore. Let's talk about intellectual property and about selling the storefront like we've been doing. I mean, let's, like, get beyond, you know, talking about, you know, a few kids and putting the burden on them to renew our economies. I mean, we really want to, we need to have a bigger conversation than that. So you want to recognize and celebrate and embrace the newcomers, but you don't want to act like, we've got to be grown-ups, right? Let's talk about some of the systemic issues. Where are these kids who are moving to Detroit, when they come of age and they have children, where are they going to go to school in Detroit?
Sure.
Can they stay in Detroit? They'd like to stay. So we've got systematic problems, and you can't really point the finger at one person. There is no villain here. It's all of us. We fell asleep at the wheel, and it's not just Detroit. So really, those are the things that we're trying to bring across in the movie, and I appreciate that I'm glad that somehow that, you know, that reached you as a viewer that's also local.
Yeah, and as we've been saying right along, it's visually striking as well. Well, we're out of time, and it doesn't matter that we are, because what this is really about is the film. And the film is going to open Friday, September 14th at the Rensen Theater in Rensen, at the Main Theater in Royal Oak, and at the Michigan Theater in Ann Arbor. And Heidi Ewing, you're going to be there for each. You can't be there.
That's
for
right.
Each
we'll be there. I think the show times will probably be announced on the website, but we'll be in all three of those in those cinemas over the course of the weekend, and hopefully visiting with locals and chatting about the movie and answering any questions they have.
And this is an extraordinary opportunity, particularly some of you listeners who never get to Detroit, they just see it maybe on the 6 o'clock news and just, you know, shake your head and what have you. This is about engagement, and not only the film itself, but the fact that Heidi Ewing, the co-director and co-producer, is going to be there as well. She's done the film with Rachel Grady, her partner in this. And the film is Detropia, Detropia. And you can go to Detropia.com. There's also an active Facebook page.
DetropiaTheFilm.com.
Yeah. Oh, the film.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I missed that. Okay.
Sorry, DetropiaTheFilm.com.
DetropiaTheFilm.com. You can always go to my website where there'll be a link, Peter Werbe, Werbe.com. Heidi Ewing, thanks for being my guest.
Thanks for having me.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
Do you need cash right now for any reason? Then you need Matt's Jewelry Brokers. At Matt's, they pay top dollar for your used or broken gold, silver, and platinum jewelry, class rings, belt buckles, coins, flatware, and more. It's really that easy. Stop into one of Matt's 5 locations with your items and walk out with cold, hard cash.
Hi, I'm Matt. We've been family-owned and operated for 30 years and pride ourselves on honesty, integrity, and paying more than the superstores do for your broken or used items just lying around the house. If it's collecting dust, we'll buy it. If it's broken, we'll buy it. If you don't want it, we'll buy it. So before you go anywhere else, stop by one of my 5 locations. In Macomb at 21 Mile and Romeo Plank, in Troy at Square Lake and Rochester Road, or my pawn shop in Southfield at 10 Mile and Greenfield. We're also in the Meyer in Clinton Township and Lennox. Check us out online at MattsJewelryBrokers.com or call us at 586-286-2866. That's 586-286-2866. When you need cash fast, go to Matt's.
Everything that rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
Mm-hmm. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. And I think all of us are aware of how much crime exists in this society. A lot of the criminal rates are down for murder, for violent crimes, and what have you. But still, all of us understand that crime, criminality, behavior that makes our life erodes the quality of our life goes on. When malefactors are caught, what's done with them? They're put in jail. And most of us say that's good. The more of these guys you can get off the streets, the better. And the fact that the United States has the highest incarceration rate, both percentage in terms of G20 countries and also total numbers in the world, I don't think bothers most of us, because we say, hey, if there's that many people doing crime, let's put as many of them in jail as we can. In fact, maybe one of the problems is there's not enough of them in jail. Maybe we should have twice as many people in jail to end the kind of crime that makes all of us worried about where we travel, the security of our house, the security of our children, our spouses, and what have you. What if, though, there was the opposite was so? What if putting people in prison actually was part of the problem? Well, a book has come my way, extraordinarily challenging in terms of what most of us think. It's called A Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America. And epidemiology, you think, well, doesn't that have to do with plagues? And why is this a plague of prisons? Well, the book is written by Ernest Drucker. He's a scholar in residence and senior research associate at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's professor emeritus of family and social medicine at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and an adjunct professor of Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. And he's directed a drug addiction treatment and AIDS research program in the poorest neighborhoods of the South Bronx from 1970 to 1990. He's the editor-in-chief of the International Harm Reduction Journal and a Fulbright senior specialist in global health. He lives in New York City. We're reaching him at his office there, and I'll tell you in a second why I read such a long introduction for Ernest Drucker and all that he's accomplished. Welcome to the broadcast, Ernest Drucker.
Thanks very much. It's nice to be here.
Well, all of that, all of what I just read, it all fits in, doesn't it, to a plague of prisons. People generally would think you'd be a sociologist, but the fact that you're involved in family and social medicine, you've done epidemiology having to do with drug addiction and AIDS, that fits in. Tell us how this medical concept could possibly relate to prisons.
Well, it sort of comes out of my own experience, which you gave a very good synopsis of, because it seems like I've gone through a lot of different lines of work, but in fact they're all related in an important way. They're all part of public health, which is how I think of my profession now, although I started life as a psychologist or an engineer before that. So I was trained as a scientist, and I working in mental health as a psychologist early on in the 60s, began to see the drug problem appear and opened the drug program in the Bronx, which grew into quite a large one, 1,000 patients in three clinics. We used a lot of heroin addicts. We treated them with methadone. And in the 1980s, that turned into an AIDS program, because during the 70s, AIDS had entered the population in New York City. It was transmitted by people sharing needles, sexual transmission as well. And by the time we had a test for HIV, half of our patients were infected with it. People had already died before we even knew what it was. And at the same time, in the 80s, which is really the opening gun of the war on drugs in earnest, everybody was getting arrested and going to jail, because my hospital also ran the jail health program at Rikers Island, the biggest prison in the world, 20,000 people at the time. And we did over 100,000 physical exams a year. We did treatment there. So we were seeing AIDS and tuberculosis and this kind of synergy of different epidemics, in the usual sense, infectious diseases. And it began to become apparent that the drug problems that these people faced, the AIDS problems, and the criminal justice problems, because they were getting arrested for doing what their illness was, which is being drug addicts, all went together in a way that not only was it very hard to separate them, there was no point in separating them. They were part of the same ecology. And those were policies which, instead of reacting to public health and mental health and addiction problems as health problems, treated them as criminal problems primarily. That was the default position. and realized that we needed a model for that. And I began to work on this idea back then, and of looking at the epidemiology of the incarceration park, because your introduction of the issue around people being concerned about their public safety, crime. Obviously, we've all been victims of crime, and many of us have been punished for crimes that we've committed ourselves, minor and major, in our lifetime. So that phenomenon is not alien to us, but it's very individual. And one of the big distinctions of public health from medicine is that medicine is highly individual. You know, it's your diagnosis, it's your treatment, it's your doctor, and you want it to be one case at a time. But public health is collective, it's the population. And quite a different level of analysis. You're concerned with how something spreads from person to person, how you can interfere in that process. And for the whole population, immunization being the classic example of how you protect populations. Prevention is the point of public health. And from that framework in which I was working and being paid with taxpayers' money, it became clear that our policies about drugs, for example, and drug addiction and drug treatment were being overwhelmed by the criminal justice approach and the war on drugs, and that needed to be understood as a negative public health policy, and blamed for some of what was going on. And what was going on was this huge expansion of the prison population. And if, as you said, it was as simple as removing people from the street who do crimes so they can't do crimes anymore, so be it. But in fact, they're not really removed. They're temporarily taken away from their families and their community. That's the punishment, basically. And they're put in these places where awful things happen to them frequently. And then they're sent back to those families and communities, the worse for wear. There's a book by the president of my college, Jeremy Travis, called But They All Come Home.
Hmm.
And the but is very significant because people don't think about that side of it. In fact, they don't think about this kind of punishment in general. They think about, except as you said, thank God they're not out selling drugs to my kids in the street. They're not mugging me or stealing my car radio, the nuisance factor, the danger, perfectly reasonable at the individual level, but exactly the wrong way to look at it as a population problem.
My guest is Ernest Drucker. He's written Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America. I can imagine people listening and saying, is this going to be one of these guys that's soft on prisoners and he thinks we're coddling you? Remember, I haven't even heard that in a long time. They used to use that phrase, you probably remember, coddling criminals.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's the politics of it revolve around that phenomenon. You know, you open your mouth. Have you heard the word drugs or drug crimes or prison in any campaign in this election year? I haven't.
No, not yet.
Remember when Dukakis ran against Bush Sr., it was like the number one problem in various polls. And Willie Horton, you know, who'd been put out of prison, you got to keep people in prison. You got to lock them up. You can't arrest your way out of the drug epidemic we have. Which, remember, doesn't just affect us. There are 40,000 people have been murdered in Mexico in the last 4 years to maintain the industry that we buy our drugs from.
But go ahead.
Imagine if somebody was, you know, we need corn, and the only place we can get corn is from Mexico. And in the process of growing that corn, they have to murder 40,000 people a year to keep the corn flowing.
That's a good analogy. I mean, actually, it's a awful but accurate analogy. But we have a crime rate that's fairly unusual in highly industrialized, wealthy countries. And it has to do, I don't think one has to be a sociologist to understand the more poor people you have, the more crime you're going to have. Is it as simple as that?
No, it's not, actually. There are many poorer countries than us.
There they go. They're going after somebody right now. I hear that.
Yeah, it might be an ambulance. Yeah. I don't know.
Okay.
It's not true. Poverty certainly is one of the things that provokes, especially crime of theft. You know, people, you know, you get, you know, Jean Valjean in Miserable, right?
Sure.
You got to feed your kids and do whatever it takes. But it's a very common association to think that the protection against crime is what explains the high prison rate. But actually, it isn't. It's the fact that once you get infected, as it were, with criminal justice involvement, you get a record, you get a fingerprint, you fall under the pale of a system that never lets you go. and frequently takes you back in, you know, the revolving door of the prison. You come out, and within 3 years, about half to two-thirds of all people out of prison go back in again, often for new offenses related to the thing that put them there in the first place, their drug addiction or their drug dealing, which they go together. One of the ways you get drugs is by selling drugs and keeping some for yourself. And this drug problem, it revolves around that. It is a chronic, recurrent condition. That's how the medical diagnostic catalogs talk about it. And everyone, you know, it's considered a disease. And yet, it's a disease you go to prison for.
So this is a revolving door. I mean, we've also heard that. But people just take it sort of, these are people that have criminal inclinations. They get, you know, they do their dirty deeds, and then they get caught. And then once they're out, they go back and do it again. So what we're talking about are, and I would think in the popular imagination, is flawed individuals, because there's enough poor people. I've lived in very poor neighborhoods, and 98% of the people there, have the same concerns as middle-class people.
And they're vulnerable, you know, and they're often the victims of crime, aren't they?
Oh, the 2%, they make life almost impossible.
But the problem is that the things that affect crime, you mentioned poverty, crowding, lack of other opportunities, the things that foster crime are well known historically. They fluctuate all over the place from time to time, from country to country, and crime rates go up in regards to all kinds of complicated reasons. So, for example, there's been a big drop in crime in the United States in the last, since 93, very precipitously, starting in 93. Which happens to be the peak of imprisonment. It's reaching its peak in the 90s. It's over 2 million people in prison now. What happened is that one of the things that this crime drop is the subject of at least a dozen books. And people say, oh, it's because we put all these bad guys away. That's why the crime dropped. It works. We should do it even more, because crime is beginning to come up, especially violent crime. It's beginning to creep up again in a number of cities. But it turns out that there are several different complicated reasons why crime dropped. One of the most interesting ones, these economists in Chicago, what are they called, the Freakonomics, those guys?
Oh, yeah, right.
Dubner and Levitt. Yeah. So they've pointed out, it's absolutely true, that one of the things that accounts for the crime drop is that most crimes are certainly most first offenses that get people in jail, arrested in jail, happen among young minority males. 16 to 26, let's say. Those are the years where you get initiated into criminal conduct as part of peer group, as part of the gang, neighborhood you're in. But that's who's doing the crimes. Way disproportionate to the number of such people the crimes are being committed by the early ones. And then, as I said, once you're initiated, you're very likely to stay in the system. Well, it turns out that the regulations, the rules and laws in the United States affecting access to abortion and birth control, which came in the 70s, had their impact 20 years later. Because let's say 20 years old is the average age of highest risk for first arrest and imprisonment. And 20 years after 1973, which is the beginning of the drug wars, is also the year that abortion became available and contraception became more widely available. And 20 years later, when the people of that generation turned 20, there were 25% less of them. The population, especially in single-parent families, poor families, very high-risk group, that population was 25% less in 93 than it was in 73. And lo and behold, there's this big crime drop in that period. The economy was important also, the availability of jobs for poor people. Those were the Clinton years in which a lot of jobs programs, the economy was doing well. The unemployment rate dropped dramatically in let's say high school dropouts could get jobs. Actually, it's the expansion of McDonald's and those that world of employment, and a few other factors. And certainly, putting 2 million people in prison means there are 2 million people who aren't going to commit crimes who had committed. But most of those crimes were nonviolent drug offenses to start with, and they didn't stop. So if you look into it, there are a lot of good reasons for why crime goes up and down. But the reasons why prison goes up or down is quite different. That's a matter of public policy. We make the decision we're going to build more prisons and put people in them. And you said before, the politics of that are, if you're against that, you're soft on crime, you're soft on drugs, get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be used to hurt you. as a political actor. So no one talks about it.
Right. And we are here on the Peter Werbe Show. My guest is Ernest Drucker. He's written A Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America. And Ernest Drucker is a scholar in residence and senior research associate at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and also professor emeritus of family and social medicine at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. So there's this intertwining of these disciplines here as we approach this. You, I'm sure, I know you have, and I know many of our listeners have heard the phrase prison industrial complex. Comes from, you know, originally military industrial complex. Is that
right.
there's a literally a culture and an economic intertwining that creates this as a permanent institution that's not going to ever solve its problem. It's a bureaucracy that just reproduces itself. Yeah, do you feel comfortable with that phrase?
Well, it's actually a phrase. It's the title of a book by my one of my gurus, a criminologist from Norway named Niels Christie, who actually is, in my mind, one of the most profound thinkers about this as a moral issue. He has a book that's available online for free, actually, called Limits to Pain, and he makes the very important point that what punishment is about, and incarceration is a very severe form of punishment, that what punishment is about is the administration of pain by the state to individuals.
Yeah.
And he raises the question is, when is enough enough? And I think most of us can relate to that and understand that in regard to children, because people punish their children for their deviance from the rules of the household. And we understand the difference between sending a kid to bed without ice cream, slapping him on the wrist, and banging his head against the wall. We understand that very well, individuals. So why don't we understand the difference between putting 100 per 100,000, 0.1% of the population in prison, and putting 700 per 100,000? Well, partly because it's invisible. It's you know, the prisons are out of sight quite deliberately, like mental hospitals. Or in fact, the prisons took the place of mental hospitals as we closed down mental hospitals beginning in the 50s. As the medications came in, we began to replace them with other institutions, prisons, which today have a very significant population of mentally ill people. People who used to, you know, they were damaged in some way psychologically. They couldn't negotiate life. They violated rules. They didn't understand them. It probably included a lot of people who are called autistic now. And those people used to go to these other institutions, and now they go into the prisons where they really do badly. They're in solitary confinement. They commit suicide at much higher rates than other prisons. And the programs that treat them with medications, they use the medications. If you look at the medical programs in most prisons, they're 75% psychiatric workers and using psychiatric meds. They don't do a very good job of it because the prison environment itself is making you crazier every day. The kind of restrictions that are imposed on you, this isolation. We have more people in isolation, solitary, in the United States. We have 50%, more than 50% of all the people in solitary in the world are in American prisons. It turns out it's economical. You don't need as many guards if you can just lock them up in a room for 23 hours a day and then let them out into a courtyard by themselves for 1 hour. Clear violation of human rights agreements that the United States is signatory to, but actually a very, very serious problem for the mentally ill who cannot control themselves and can't take advantage of the medication. So you get this kind of synergy of so many different factors once you put millions of people in prison. Remember, if there are millions in prison, there are three or four or five times as many who have been in prison.
Sure, and families that are affected. But tell me a little about the idea of this prison industrial complex. That is to say that so many people and so many groups of people have a vested interest in maintaining it as it is, from construction workers to prison guards. That's one of the reasons that it's hard.
You said it. You said it. It's like every other industry. It agitates for its interests. It tries to hold on to its market share. It expands if possible because there are economies of scale. There's significant privatization in the American system. Half the states in the union do not have any privatization. They don't use private companies to run their prisons or do anything. Although, if you look at the whole industry, building the prisons, supplying food, medical care, those are private. Those are done through the private sector. But the actual running of the prisons and the setting of its goals and objectives is not done in half the states. But the other half of the states, often states with the highest prison rates, have 25% of their prisons under the control of for-profit companies. Now, prisons are underfunded, famously. Even though they're very expensive, let's say $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year for a year in prison, when you have one prison guard for every two or three prisoners, it's an expensive proposition. And there's not enough money. The food quality has deteriorated badly. The money for medical care has gone way down in the prison system because budgets are being cut everywhere. And when you add in the privatization of prisons, there's the profit factor. A company called Corrections Corporation of America is on the stock exchange. Their stock has been doing very well, thank you, throughout this whole period.
Let me do this, though, because I'm looking at the clock. I can't remember an interview that's gone by this quickly. We only have about 4.5 minutes left. My guest is Ernest Drucker. He's written A Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America. We're looking at the situation. It's just awful. I mean, when we just came out, what was happening in Los Angeles County Jail, the horrible treatment, the torture that's...
cover of the book. The cover of the book is from Los Angeles.
Well, I was going to just ask you that. It's hard almost to describe this one relatively small room, which I can't count these guys up, must be at least 100 in double-decker bunks just really close to one another. What do we do? Do we just say, okay, guys, go home?
The Supreme Court has done that in California because they've been in violation of crowding rules and medical care rules for so long. They've been under all sorts of court orders to scale down the system. They insisted that they remove 30,000 people. And what they've done is they've shifted them into the county jails instead of the state's prison system. The state prison system medical care has been in receivership for 3 years now. Because of the number of people who died from inadequate medical care. It's interesting, the health care talk, prisoners are among the only civilians, the military has prison health care, obviously, but the only civilians in America who have an entitlement to medical care are prisoners under the Eighth Amendment, where the ruling was in the 60s that to deprive them of medical care was cruel and unusual punishment. Huh. So now they only do it for people who aren't prisoners.
But listen, you live in Manhattan, you work in Manhattan, I live in Detroit, and we know there's a problem with predatory neighbors, and they wind up to actually be our neighbor, maybe not next door, but in our city. What do we do? I mean, we have these people, these antisocial, asocial people around. How do we, without creating this horrible situation, which American prisons are, what do we do? Which is a pretty tough, big question. I realize.
Well, it's a tough question, but a big question, but it's actually not that tough. You do the same thing that you would do for anyone you cared about who's in trouble. And here it's not the individual again, but like the city of Detroit you mentioned is a city in trouble because it's lost its industrial economic base. Abandonment of buildings. I've seen enough films about it, including Michael Moore's. Michigan in general is suffering from this. In a country that had its priorities straight, instead of spending this money on the prisons and continuing to worsen the lot of those who aren't able to survive that situation, they become predatory. They're arrested. Nothing to lose after a while. The guns and the violence of the gangs in prisons transfer to the outside world very quickly. The connections you have in prison become the only peer group you have outside that you can be part of anymore. You keep feeding this system. You're throwing gasoline on the fire. Those funds need to be used for, all too well. It's housing, it's education, it's social services, it's medical care. These are fundamental human rights in most developed democracies, not ours. You know, with this fight that's going on with the Tea Party, I just finished writing an op-ed piece called Tea Party Justice, where the kind of vengefulness that's abroad now about every problem, from immigration to to drug users, to the use of the death penalty. If you saw this debate with Perry the other night where Brian Williams asked him about the 234 executions that took place in his term of office, and the audience breaks out in rapturous applause before he can even answer. Huh. This is very chilling when you think about the kind of retributive, vengeful kind of attitude that's abroad.
And this unfortunately, we're completely out of time, and this vengeful, punitive approach has not worked, and maybe as the economy worsens, it'll get even worse with more overcrowding, more people going through the so-called justice system. This is a book you should read, A Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America. My guest has been Ernest Drucker. We never even got to talking about the website for the book, plagueofprisons.com. And on there, there's a lot of resources that you can go to besides just seeing the book. There'll also be a link on my website, peterwerby.com. Ernest Drucker, thanks for being a guest on the show.
Well, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Get all of Drew and Mike's best moments delivered right to your computer or mobile device. The Drew and Mike Podcast, brought to you by Matt's Jewelry Brokers. For fast cash, call Matt's at 586-286-2866. Subscribe today at WRIF.com.